Peter Davenport at Seattle's UFO Reporting Center, a place that gathers reports from all of you on what's going on out there. And what's going on out there tonight includes some rather strange occurrences in Arizona. Here is Peter Davenport. Peter.
Good evening, Art.
Hi. What in the world is going on?
Well, I'm not sure myself, but it's been a very busy night in the skies above Arizona tonight. Just about 3 hours ago, we started taking calls nose to tail from all over Arizona. The first call came in from a retired police officer who lives in Paulden, Arizona.
Paulden.
That's, I guess, about 150 or 200 miles straight north of Phoenix,
okay.
North of Prescott, Arizona.
Right.
He was out with his family driving. They saw a cluster of lights. It looked like four or five, maybe six of them in a large cluster, followed by a single lone light behind them, moving from northwest to southeast, approximately. That was the first of what turned out to be many calls. I've taken about 18 calls tonight from Arizona. Those objects were seen over Paulden. A minute later, they were seen over Prescott, Arizona.
A minute later.
That's it's got to be at least 50, maybe more like 100 miles between Paulden and Prescott, Arizona. Two or three minutes later, they were seen all over Phoenix, Arizona, over Glendale, over Tempe, and literally the calls were coming in on top of each other.
Listen, I can tell you it's true because I sat down here at the board just before the program, began to answer a few calls,
mm-hmm.
and the Arizona calls were frantic. Art, you should see what's going on down here.
Yeah.
So what are people saying? What is the best description of these objects so far?
Yeah, there have been multiple descriptions, but the people up in northern Arizona saw lights that were distinctly red. By the time they'd gotten down to Phoenix, they were white, the color of stars, bluish-white, people described. But, excuse me, I'm suffering from a cold here tonight. But
so are most of the people I know.
Yeah. It is still not clear to me whether we're dealing with one extremely large object or whether, in point of fact, there were five objects. I think the best report, one of the best we took from Phoenix, was from an amateur astronomer who was looking at these objects. He apparently has very good vision. He was able to discern that each one of the five lights that he was looking at itself individually was made up of two lights, two faint lights. It looks to me as though we are dealing with a fleet of objects. Another observer reported that when one turned, they all turned together as if by the same command. Now, I don't know if that's changing orientation of lights on a single large object or what. We rarely really know what we're dealing with here, but there's no doubt but what there was a dramatic sighting over Arizona.
All right, did anybody take out a camera?
One person that we talked to went for his camcorder. By the time he got back a minute later, everything was gone.
Yeah.
Most people did not see these things for more than 2 or 3 minutes. One party said he estimated that it was 10 minutes that he'd been watching it, but he wasn't sure. That's really not enough time to go dig out the old camcorder from your steamer trunk. And
I know. I know it.
But most people should prepare themselves and get their, if they own camcorders, get the batteries charged, always keep fresh tape in it, and be ready to catch something on film if you see it. But interestingly, excuse me, we took two other dramatic sightings from the state of Washington. I have no idea whether these were in any way related to the sightings over Arizona. But we had one object reported from Castle Rock, Washington tonight by the 911 facility down in that locale. There was a brilliant, intensely bright flash, followed by a huge veil of cascading sparks coming down out of the sky. We don't know what it was, but we've been taking a lot of calls very similar to that over the last roughly 2 or 3 weeks, I would say. Certainly something's going on, Art. I just thought your listeners tonight would like to get a fresh report of what was seen to occur over Arizona.
Okay. How long ago, when was the last reported sighting in Arizona?
The last reported sighting was at about 8:35 p.m. tonight
Okay.
That's Arizona time.
Well, a lot of people, I guess, enjoyed it. I hope they enjoyed it because I got a lot of calls. You got a lot of calls.
Yeah.
Something happened.
Yeah. One thing I might add, if we have just a second more.
Sure.
I tried to contact Duke Air Force Base tonight. They took a lot of calls on this. Two people reported to us that as the objects moved to the south generally over Phoenix, people saw two what appeared to be military jets coming from the northwest or maybe the north, going flying right at the formation of objects.
Uh-huh.
And the objects suddenly disappeared very shortly thereafter. And the two apparently jet aircraft, they could be heard to be jet aircraft, turned around and went back to the northwest. That's in the direction of Luke Air Force Base.
Luke didn't want to talk to you.
No, I called Luke just less than 30 minutes ago. I was on the line to Luke. I was told by a staff sergeant in the command post there that he could not put me in touch with a commissioned officer at Luke Air Force Base. He represented that he was the commander of Luke Air Force Base tonight.
Really?
I spent 4 years in the military. I know you
did. What's going on here?
That gentleman, that staff sergeant, may have been telling me the exact truth, but times must have changed since I was in the military.
Well, if he's the commander of the base, then I'll tell you the cutbacks have been underrated, underreported.
Yes, that's a good point. But he said he was unable to put me in touch with a duty officer or a command officer at all tonight, that I'd have to talk to their public relations officer tomorrow.
All right. Well, maybe giving out your reporting number up there will get us some more detailed reports, or who knows, maybe somebody got a picture. So let's give out your number.
Yeah, the UFO hotline in Seattle is area code 206-722-3000. 722-3000 in Seattle. And I'll give out our new website address, if I may.
I didn't even know you had one.
It's one of those easy-to-remember website addresses we just started 2 weeks ago.
Yes.
It's www.ufocenter, one word, UFOCENTER.com. And I hope tomorrow we'll be able to put a statement on that website about what happened over Arizona tonight.
All right. We will get a link in to www.ufocenter.com. We'll get a link in to you, and we'll look for that information to appear.
That'll be fine.
Peter, thank you.
Thank you very much, Art.
That's Peter Davenport at the UFO Reporting Center in Seattle. So as you can see, there is a lot going on within hours of this program. And this program is about to deal with the subject of UFOs. Virgin they actually are. But they are the U.S. Virgin Islands. South into South America, north well to the pole, and worldwide on the internet. This is Coast to Coast AM, and it's a hot time in the old town tonight. Things are a-poppin'. Peter Davenport, who is at the Seattle UFO Reporting Center, has a lot to tell us about what's been going on this evening, this night, perhaps even now, in the skies over Arizona and elsewhere. So we're going to get a quick report from Peter Davenport. Then we're going to go to Sean David Morton, who is... You know, we'll have to ask him about that. Really a prophet, I guess, an investigative reporter, certainly for many TV programs and so forth and so on, regarding UFOs. And he's got three new UFO photographs that you've never seen before, but can see right now because we've got them up on the website. One of them allegedly taken from inside a UFO. Of a Pleiadian, what looks to me like a Pleiadian beam ship. Another incredible photograph taken by a Pleiadian contactee from the top floor of a condo complex next to a golf course in Miami. And an amazingly clear photo of a red and gold plasma craft. Kind of interesting stuff, and all up on the website right now. So we will talk with Sean David Morton about those photographs, about UFOs, about prophecy in general, about what's coming. about Egypt because he just got back from Egypt. So we'll talk a bit about the pyramids and what the world is going on at Giza. So we've got a very full plate. That's all ahead tonight. Listen, if you own any stocks, mutual funds, or bonds, you better listen. The Federal Reserve bumped interest rates a quarter point the other day. And they may not be done, and they did that to erase or eradicate apparently invisible inflation. They're a strange group, the Fed. They are not actually a federal agency. That is the first thing you should really know about them. They are private. It's really strange. Now, this is a private agency that can affect your savings, your bonds, your mutual funds, your life. So you should know about them. And North American Trading is willing to send you information on the Fed. All right? All you've got to do is call them. It's a free call. Mention my name, if you would, and say, Art Bell asked me to call and request this info on the Fed. And they'll send it to you without obligation. The number is 1-800-359-4255. That's 1-800-359-4255. Are you overweight? Would you like to lose an average 8 to 10 pounds in the next month? We know that fiber helps sweep fat out of the digestive tract like a broom, reducing the amount of fat your body stores as excess weight. Well, let me tell you about a revolutionary fiber, chitosan. It's a natural fiber that comes from shellfish. It not only sweeps fat, but also absorbs up to 10 times more fat than other fibers. You can get this fiber in a formula called ChitoSlim. ChitoSlim is effective because you can lose weight without changing your eating habits. And there are no stimulants. It's a gentle, effective way to lose excess weight. Here's the special offer. When you order a 90-day supply of ChitoSlim, you'll get an antioxidant moisturizing cream absolutely free. Call 1-800-557-4627. It's guaranteed to work or your money back, and it's not available in stores. So call 1-800-557-4627. That's 1-800-557-4627. You've got nothing to lose but the fat. He is Peter Davenport at Seattle's UFO Reporting Center, a place that gathers reports from all of you on what's going on out there. And what's going on out there tonight includes some rather strange occurrences in Arizona. Here is Peter Davenport. Peter.
Good evening, Art.
Hi. Hi. What in the world is going on?
Well, I'm not sure myself, but it's been a very busy night in the skies above Arizona tonight. Just about 3 hours ago, we started taking calls nose to tail from all over Arizona. The first call came in from a retired police officer who lives in Paulden, Arizona.
Paulden.
That's, I guess, about 150 or 200 miles straight north of Phoenix,
okay.
North of Prescott, Arizona.
Right.
He was out with his family driving. They saw a cluster of lights. It looked like four or five, maybe six of them in a large cluster, followed by a single lone light behind them, moving from northwest to southeast, approximately. That was the first of what turned out to be many calls. I've taken about 18 calls tonight from Arizona. Those objects were seen over Paulden. A minute later, they were seen over Prescott, Arizona.
A minute later.
That's it's got to be at least 50, maybe more like 100 miles between Paulden and Prescott, Arizona. Two or three minutes later, they were seen all over Phoenix, Arizona, over Glendale, over Tempe, and literally the calls were coming in on top of each other.
Listen, I can tell you it's true because I sat down here at the board just before the program, began to answer a few calls, and the Arizona calls were frantic. Art, you should see what's going on down here.
Yeah.
So what are people saying? What is the best description of these objects so far?
Yeah, there have been multiple descriptions, but the people up in northern Arizona saw lights that were distinctly red. By the time they'd gotten down to Phoenix, they were white, the color of stars, bluish white, people described. But, excuse me, I'm suffering from a cold here tonight. But
so are most of the people I know.
Yeah. it is still not clear to me whether we're dealing with one extremely large object or whether, in point of fact, there were five objects. I think the best report, one of the best we took from Phoenix, was from an amateur astronomer who was looking at these objects. He apparently has very good vision. He was able to discern that each one of the five lights that he was looking at itself individually was made up of two lights, two faint lights. It looks to me as though we are dealing with a fleet of objects. Another observer reported that when one turned, they all turned together as if by the same command. Now, I don't know if that's changing orientation of lights on a single large object or what. We rarely really know what we're dealing with here, but there's no doubt but what there was a dramatic sighting over Arizona.
All right, did anybody take out a camera?
One person that we talked to went for his camcorder. By the time he got back a minute later, everything was gone.
Yep.
Most people did not see these things for more than 2 or 3 minutes. One party said he estimated that it was 10 minutes that he'd been watching it, but he wasn't sure. That's really not enough time to go dig out the old camcorder from your steamer trunk. And
I know. I know it.
But most people should prepare themselves and if they own camcorders, get the batteries charged, always keep fresh tape in it, and be ready to catch something on film if you see it. But interestingly, we took two other dramatic sightings from the state of Washington. I have no idea whether these were in any way related to the sightings over Arizona, but we had one object reported from Castle Rock, Washington tonight by the 911 facility down in that locale. There was a brilliant, intensely bright flash followed by a huge veil of cascading sparks coming down out of the sky. We don't know what it was, but we've been taking a lot of calls very similar to that over the last roughly 2 or 3 weeks, I would say. Certainly something's going on, Art. I just thought your listeners tonight would like to get a fresh report of what was seen to occur over Arizona.
Okay, how long ago, when was the last reported sighting in Arizona?
Reported sighting was at about 8:35 p.m. tonight.
Okay.
That's Arizona time.
Well, a lot of people, I guess, enjoyed it. I hope they enjoyed it because I got a lot of calls. You got a lot of calls.
Yeah.
Something happened.
Yeah. One thing I might add, if we have just a second more.
Sure.
I tried to contact Luke Air Force Base tonight. They took a lot of calls on this. Two people reported to us that as the objects moved to the south generally over Phoenix, people saw two what appeared to be military jets coming from the northwest or maybe the north, flying right at the formation of objects.
Uh-huh.
And the objects suddenly disappeared very shortly thereafter, and the two apparently jet aircraft, they could be heard to be jet aircraft, turned around and went back to the northwest. That's in the direction of Luke Air Force Base.
Luke didn't want to talk to you, huh?
No, I called Luke just less than 30 minutes ago. I was on the line to Luke. I was told by a staff sergeant in the command post there that he could not put me in touch with a commissioned officer at Luke Air Force Base. He represented that he was the commander of Luke Air Force Base tonight.
Really?
I spent 4 years in the military. I know you
did. What's going on here?
That gentleman, that staff sergeant, may have been telling me the exact truth, but times must have changed since I was in the military.
Well, if he's the commander of the base, then I'll tell you the cutbacks have been underrated, underreported.
Yes, that's his point. But he said he was unable to put me in touch with a duty officer or a command officer at all tonight, that I'd have to talk to their public relations officer tomorrow.
All right. Well, maybe giving out your reporting number up there will get us some more detailed reports, or who knows, maybe somebody got a picture. So let's give out your number.
Yeah, the UFO hotline in Seattle is area code 206-722-3000. 722-3000 in Seattle. And I'll give out our new website address, if I may.
I didn't even know you had one.
It's one of those easy-to-remember website addresses. We just started 2 weeks ago.
Yes.
It's www.ufocenter, one word, UFOCENTER.com. And I hope tomorrow we'll be able to put a statement on that website about what happened over Arizona tonight.
All right. We will get a link in to www.ufocenter.com. We'll get a link in to you, and we'll look for that information to appear.
That'll be fine.
Peter, thank you.
Thank you very much, Art.
That's Peter Davenport at the UFO Reporting Center in Seattle. So as you can see, there is a lot going on within hours of this program. And this program is about to deal with the subject of UFOs. We have had Sean David Morton on before, but a lot of you will not know him because there are so many new affiliates out there. So, who is he? Well, he has a newsletter called the Delphi Associates Newsletter. With a very, very high hit rate of predictions, prophecy. He has researched Area 51, worked with Strange Universe, a writer-producer there. He's worked with UFO contactees, Unsolved Mysteries, Sightings, author of the best-selling book called The Millennium Factor, a UFO Library magazine, Ancient Mysteries Sightings, and so forth and so on. He worked for Gene Roddenberry as his protege. Now, how many people would like to have that job? Redeveloping Star Trek for TV in 1981 and 82. That must have been fun. That really must have been fun. He has a BA in Political Science from USC, a Bachelor of Fine Arts in Drama from USC. Attended the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Arts with an advanced degree in drama. The British International School of Cairo, Egypt. There he spent two semesters studying Arabic, Egyptology, and Middle Eastern politics. Boy, you could spend a lifetime on that one. Here is Sean David Morton. Hi. I'm always wanting to call you Martin for some reason. Morton, Sean David Morton, hi.
Well, thank you, Art. It's just it's such a pleasure. It's been a couple of years since I've been on the show, and it's just been it's been too long, my friend. Congratulations on all your great success and all the great things that you're doing.
Thank you. I feel blessed.
Well, it's you're doing great work, and I said that before when I was on the show, and now that you've gone, now that you're living large, as they say, you know, greater congratulations are in order.
Thank you.
I was, as a matter of fact, I was just looking through back issues of the Delphi newsletter, and on February 18th of 1996, I was saying one of the predictions was that UFOs would make dazzling displays over major U.S. cities. The phenomenon that began in Mexico in July of 1991 is about to spread to El Norte in a big way. New York, Arizona, Los Angeles, Reno, Chicago, Miami, Seattle. These sightings will be filmed and picked up for the first time by the national media. So that was a prediction that was made in 96.
Let me tell you a little bit about a guest I've got coming up next week from such a different direction. He was close to two popes. He's Father Malachi Martin.
Oh, my God, Malachi.
Malachi, yeah. I'm going to have Malachi on. And you know why his secretary called me earlier today?
Why?
He said, Malachi wants to comment on what's coming in the skies this spring. I said, oh, okay. Well, no problem.
Malachi used to be a professor at the University of Santa Clara. And years ago, I actually helped edit some chapters of a book that Malachi wrote called Hostage to the Devil, which was a fascinating book on demonic possession and exorcism. And as a matter of fact, Malachi has a new book out, which is brilliant, that I recommend to all your listeners. It's called Windswept House.
That's correct.
And there were just accusations that were made that were glossed over by most of the American and the European press by a black cardinal who was from the churches in South Africa, who actually made the accusation that there were satanic rites and rituals actually being performed by very, very high up members of the Holy See, the High Church of Cardinals. And it was something that was just kind of glossed over, and hopefully something that you'll ask Malachi when he's on the show very soon, because I don't know. I mean, this should have sent shockwaves to the Catholic community that cardinals are performing black masses in St. Peter's Basilica.
Of course. But anyway, he apparently wants to say something about our skies this spring. So something's in the works.
Well, wonderful. Malachi, you could not have picked a better, kinder, wiser, gentler man to be on your show. He's a wonderful, wonderful guy.
All right. Anyway, look, let us begin. You don't have your own website.
No, unfortunately.
But we've sure got one. And you sent me some photographs earlier tonight.
Yes.
And along with those photographs, the text you sent me about each one is on the website. Having said that, most people, you know, don't have computers. So let's begin by telling the audience about each picture. Picture number one is of apparently a UFO, it says, taken from another UFO?
Right. One of the greatest UFO contactee cases that's just about to hit, we've sort of been standing on it for a couple of months now, because we want the case investigated right. We don't want the case to collapse and go off in a bunch of different directions, kind of like the Billy Meier case did between 75 and 1981.
Yes.
Originally in Switzerland, which just got mired in a morass of egos and different investigators and a lot of wild claims. So we're literally trying to do this one right, because we think that this person is about to be probably the most important and most credible UFO contactee on the planet. He calls himself Audrain. That's his public name. He's a very humble guy. He moved here from Cuba. His family fled Havana when he was about 5 years old, and he started having actual contacts with a race of Pleiadian extraterrestrials. He claims that these Pleiadians are from the Alcyon star system, and that for example, he says that the Billy Meier ships, and you'll notice that the ships in the photographs actually look very similar to the Meier craft, that the Meier ships supposedly came from the star system of Tegeta, and that this is the same bunch in the same constellation, but, you know, living in a different star system. They're very interesting looking. The women are very, very tall. They're about 6.5 feet tall. This is so he claims.
Really?
The men are about 7 feet 2 inches tall. They have very large cat-like eyes. They've got the interesting thing about it is they don't have bridges to the nose. The nose comes sort of straight down from the forehead, very much like you would see in a Catholic statue of Jesus or the Virgin Mary. When his contact started, when he was about 10 years old, he just recently started, about in the last 10 years or so, started taking photographs of these craft. And the time that I've spent with him down in Miami, he literally has a photo book that I would say has probably about 1,000 photos. In the photo that you have on the website, photo number one,
yes,
he's actually riding in a Pleiadian craft, taking these photographs from the view screen, or literally out the window of the craft. And what you're seeing in that particular picture is two variations of Pleiadian beam ships. The one on the left is actually has a series of ridges on it, and that's supposedly the most advanced of the Pleiadian ships, which actually not only has interstellar capability, but also is able to travel in time. The other craft is what they call a Type 1 variation. It's very, very simplistic. It's sort of the first generation of the Pleiadian beam ships. And the unusual thing about the photo is that it's taken in the air about 30,000 feet above Florida, where you can actually see the outline of the Florida Keys underneath, and you can actually also see in the photo.
I can make them out.
Yes. Well, you can also see an outline of a little rainbow in there as well, because the rainbow is actually reflecting off the clouds and the sunlight.
This looks exactly like the Meyer ships.
Except these craft are being photographed from the top. And,
right.
And the one on the left is a little different because of the slats. And there's some close-up photos that I'll actually send you of that ship on the left. I'll start posting some stuff on your website now that we're back in contact again.
Where did you get these photographs?
From Audrain. He's got, I mean, the photos he's got are amazing. Just to give
these
you
are, these are of the quality of the Meyer photographs, only in this case, these are taken actually in the air, folks. You've got to get up and get a look. We're going to pause here, Sean, at the bottom of the hour. So you might want to quickly take a visit to my website. It is www.artbell.com. Sean David Morton is my guest. He will be back.
Coast to Coast AM, Monday night, Tuesday morning. Tonight, Chancellor Broadcasting presents from March 13th, Art's riveting five-hour interview with Prophet Sean David Morton and his latest insights on Egypt. And now, the best of Art Bell.
10:50. Now, back to Sean David Morton, and we are describing some, I guess, these photographs would have to be considered to be the best, most clear photographs of a UFO, or UFOs in this case, since the Billy Meyer photographs. Do you think that's a fair statement, Sean?
Absolutely. And as a matter of fact, the evidence of proof in this particular case is the confidence level is actually much higher than the Meyer case because the photos aren't being stolen. We actually have original negatives to the photographs to take a look at.
Oh, you do?
Oh, yes. We've also got, some of the amazing, let me just give you an idea of some of the photographs that I've seen just sitting personally with this gentleman. His girlfriend, apparently, is also allowed to ride on the craft with him. And after an interview with her, you know, she's very funny. She's this very beautiful, about 26-year-old Hispanic girl.
Mm-hmm.
And she was talking about how excited she was to actually ride on the ships. And then she said after about five times, it just got boring.
Boring?
Because it didn't feel like they were going anywhere.
Boring?
All they did was look at the view screens, and she said that they were just watching people sleep and that they were doing experiments. And she works as a cashier at the Publix down there in Florida. And so she was saying, no, I have to work most of the time, so I don't have time to go on the ships. And then as Audrain is actually looking through this photo album, she says, oh, look, there's me. Show him the picture of me. And he turns it around, and you see they've gone on a trip out into the Florida Everglades. And in this shot, you see a beam ship floating in the background, probably about 5-6 feet off the ground. And in the foreground, you see the edge of the same craft, and she's actually climbing up a ladder getting in the ship.
Sean, let me stop you here before we go on to the next photograph, and let me ask you, because I've got to try to understand why the Pleiadians or any other race from any other place, why do they pick people like Billy Meyer, like these folks in Florida, or other individuals to get really chummy with? I mean, come on aboard, have a ride, take photos of us, all that sort of thing. Why?
Well, all I can tell you is what Audrain told me about this. His case is kind of unique because he, and as I said, I don't know if this is true or not. This part of the story, I will simply relate it to you as he related it to me. When he was 10 years old, when his contacts actually began, he said that he was a rather diseased, a somewhat mentally deficient child who was kicking a football out by the Orange Bowl when a flanks of ships actually came down. And his description of this was that the lead ship came down, picked him up into the craft where he saw, where he was placed in a large glass tube. And in this glass tube, the physical soul of the boy was somehow removed and or lifted up and like placed in a container or a sphere of some kind. And he says that the soul of that boy or that individual, now as I said, we're getting into the sort of a wild area here, but he said that that soul was then implanted into a young boy somewhere down in South America, a very good family, well-bred, well-raised, and that this very tall Pleiadian, whose name was Audrain, but 7 foot tall Pleiadian, laid in the other glass tube, where something like 20% of his soul essence was then taken out and placed into his body. So he said that when he actually got up and looking at this very large man, he said it was like looking back into a mirror. And he describes it as it being sort of like almost like our playing a video game or watching something going on in another room through a video camera. that the Pleiadian is an archaeologist. He's a an anthropologist, and he wanted to study the late 20th century and the early part of the 21st century because of the major changes and massive shift in consciousness that was going to be happening. And it was literally a way for this being to supposedly be in these two places at once. And he says that that's how his contacts began. So they literally come and they get him and pick him up. Why is it just certain individuals? The Pleiadians seem to be telepathic. They seem to be empathic and telepathic, and being around human beings in general makes them physically ill. It's sort of like being trapped in a hot car with the windows rolled up with a smelly Pomeranian that won't shut up. Human beings have this food, money, sex mindset that just keeps going over and over and over again.
That's us, all right.
That makes these beings, you know, literally physically ill. So it's very difficult for them to be around anything.
They are so ascended that they cannot stand to be around our base selves, eh?
So he claims. Mm-hmm. And he says that that's also presented some major problems for... because I'm relating things.
Fine, so maybe I'll start calling them the stuck-up tall guys, huh?
The stuck-up tall guys, exactly. From outer space.
Anyway, they are absolutely incredible photographs. All right, photograph number 2, mm-hmm. taken in 95, right. Again by same Pleiadian contact.
Yes.
The interesting thing here is, first of all, am I seeing many... UFOs in this, or am I seeing one in travel? I can't quite figure that out.
No, there's actually four ships in the photograph. And
four
ships actually are, each ship is a different design. You'll actually see that the first two craft that you saw in the first photograph are the crafts on the right and the left, and then there's another variation, and then actually the most interesting craft is the one that's on the far left. Now, when these... He lived, or he just moved just recently, but he lived on the top story of a condo off a golf course in Miami Beach. And these Pleiadian craft would literally open the invisibility screens long enough for him to take these photographs. And in that particular photo, what you see across the photo is he's crouching down, taking the photograph up through the railing of his patio in order to get these four ships in perspective. Now, he's got dozens of photographs of whole V-shaped flanks of ships that, he's actually got this on video as well, of a fleet of craft, and then a helicopter starts coming in. His house is just ringed by these weird black helicopters that keep coming around every time he's having a contact, and then you can see the phases of this whole flanks of ships actually just disappearing right before your eyes. We did a piece on Audrain for Strange Universe, and one of the most fascinating pieces of video footage that we had was of an actual craft where the invisibility field turns on right in front of you, and the craft literally disappears right before your eyes. So what you're seeing in that photo is you're seeing four different phases of Pleiadian technology. Now, the one on the far left, and the reason it's the most interesting, is that he says that that sort of short, stumpy craft was actually built, apparently, by the Germans in the 1910s and 20s.
All right, the one on the very far left is barely in the photograph at all.
Yes, it's the one that looks like a Volkswagen. That one. He said that that what was going on, and this has been a big mystery for me, because I was always very curious as to, I was a NASA brat. My dad was a public relations director for NASA. We had, unrepentant Nazi German scientists, who were running our space program, who would come over to our house with the SS symbol still on the collar and these, long leather coats.
Really?
And I would say, gee, where'd you get the neat coat, mister? And they'd say, the Führer gave me this coat, young man, and a fighter man never lives in the Führer. And these are the guys who were running our space program. I always wondered about the flying saucer technology, the electromagnetic stuff, and how it all fit in with this whole theory of German UFOs. And if Hitler was developing this technology, where did it go? I mean, why didn't he use it to, win the war or kill more people or invade America or whatever?
That would be the biggest question.
Well, and the question, what happened was, is that... apparently, these Pleiadians, in the early part of the 20th century, around 1900, 1910, and 1920, were in contact with a group of these German scientists, because these scientists were the only ones that were advanced enough to understand their concepts of propulsion, because they were very much going along the Nikola Tesla lines of electromagnetic gravitation and using the Earth's field, et cetera, et cetera. So they gave them some technology to build these craft. Now, when Hitler started to come into power in the late 20s to the early part of the 1930s, the Pleiadians literally went crazy. I mean, they freaked out because they thought, oh my God, we've now given this technology to these people, and the people that we're in contact with are either going to be killed or abused or used or put in concentration camps, and this technology...
Well, this, though, implies that the Pleiadians, very technologically advanced, were politically clueless. Is, would that be right?
Yes, completely. And the claim then was is that and some of the other photographs that I've seen are of this gigantic base that they have down in the Horseshoe Cascade Mountain Range down in Brazil. But they basically took these scientists lock, stock, and barrel and said, look, we can't leave you here on this planet or in this society because you'll either be killed or used for an evil purpose. And they basically just rounded them all up, which explains why a lot of these scientists simply disappeared. And supposedly many of them went to Brazil, but a number of these, as fantastic as this sound, a number of these scientists supposedly were then taken off to this Pleiadian planet, which is called Remul in the Alcyone star system. Now, this leads to a whole other gist of what he's been talking about what the Pleiadians were deciding to do with the planet. And he says the first group thinks they should just leave us alone and we'll destroy ourselves. The second group literally thinks that the planet should be completely just knocked over, rescue the people that deserve to be rescued, allow the planet to just roll a couple of times, and then repopulate the planet with people who deserve to live here.
I wonder how they would decide who it is who deserves. I mean, these are people who liked the Nazis, so, I mean, how are they to decide who deserves to live?
Indeed, indeed. But the third alternative that they have is these, is this human colony that they seem to have on their planet that has about 100,000 human beings in the colony, where they've now had a generation of children who are human children from Earth, but who've now been raised in sort of a stranger in a strange land, Valentine Michael Smith reality, where they've been taught Pleiadian religion and meditation and science. And according to him, he says that these people are actually now being repatriated back to Earth at about the tune of about 5,000 people at a time, which is perfect because now the Pleiadians don't have to deal with us, right, because we make them physically ill. So now we've got this whole generation of kids who are now starting to return.
So they're stuck-up, tall, political idiots.
Now, who now look, are having kids who they're bringing back to this planet.
Yeah, do you believe all this, Sean?
I'm just relating the story as it's
No, I understand that. Just sort of for the record, do you buy into all this?
Well, when you've got a guy who's showing you...
Fair enough. The photographs are very...
Of the base.
I agree. Look,
and
they're very impressive.
If you've got a guy who's showing you pictures that he's taken of Disneyland... on the ground with, like,
really?
7-foot-tall guys working on
them. Oh, those I've got to see.
I'll get them to you. You know, I'm just glad that we're talking again. So
Well, we were never not talking. I mean, we just sort of went out of touch for a while. There was never any bad blood anywhere.
I didn't mean that. I just meant that we've both just been so busy.
It's true.
That it's just been difficult to just touch base. So I didn't mean to say it that way.
Okay. Well, look. So these incredible photographs, two of them. Now there is a third photograph on my website tonight. Mm-hmm. This one appears to be a plasma ship. Is that a fair?
Yes. Fascinating case. I met Carlos Diaz about 6 months ago, and Carlos, gosh, as far as the scientific community is concerned in Mexico, Carlos Diaz is presenting some of the finest physical evidence that we've ever seen.
We all know how many sightings there have been in Mexico.
Right. So much so that people are actually taking entire tours down to Tepoztlan, which is the town about 60 miles south of Mexico City where Carlos lives.
Right.
And apparently these plasma craft are flying around so much down there that people are actually taking tours down there to see them.
Anybody have any idea why Mexico?
Primarily, according to Carlos, because there are a massive number of earth changes that are going to take place in Mexico City. You are going to see, according to him once again, and actually from what I've seen in my visions of this, a massive earthquake that I think will shatter and probably destroy Mexico City, and I don't really see any hope of that changing as far as this timeline is concerned. He says that these beings And Carlos is a very nice, very humble man. His wife, Margarita, is an architect. She speaks very good English. Carlos does not speak English. Huh. Carlos does not know where these beings are from. I asked them, I say, where are they from? He says, I don't know. They haven't told me. I said, what do you call them? He says, I call them my amigos because they're just, you know, they're just my friends. He's been having these contacts for about 17 years, and they've never taken him off the planet. In other words, he's never gone up to see the moon or other star systems or whatever. He claims that they take him into the Earth and that they take him into these gigantic subterranean caverns that are called the Halls of Remembrance. And in these caverns, there are these gigantic plasmoid, sort of ellipsoidal plasma-like eggs that he says that when you put your hands or your head inside these eggs, he says that you can hear music like Mozart or Bach, and you can see flora and fauna samples of reindeer and grass and certain types of insects. And he says that all of this is being done because these beings are so afraid that mankind is going to destroy the ecological balance of the surface of the planet that they are taking, like, they're actually taking samples to store inside these halls to then repopulate the surface of the Earth should something terrible happen.
You know how this sounds.
Oh, of course. But when you, once again, I'm relating the stories for you and your listeners of the people who are talking about actually, I mean, how much more fantastic does it sound somebody actually taking, you know, film or video or photographs of UFOs that actually appear on command? Let me, another thing I'll send you too, Art, is let me send you the video that we have from Carlos, where Carlos sets up a video camera out the window of his kitchen, goes out in front of the camera at night, shines a flashlight on himself, walks into a field about 50 yards away, is shining the flashlight on himself, and the craft literally from out of nowhere physically appears above him and just hangs there for about 20 solid minutes. And then just, you know, as just the way it came. It,
all right, to summarize for everybody, if you go back to the Billy Meyer case or what you have been describing, these are basically UFOs that communicate telepathically that can be almost called on to appear, or in some cases they will announce they are going to appear, I think back in the Billy Meyer case, and can be literally called mentally at any time. So the question is begged, Sean, do you think these really are craft from elsewhere, or could these be creations of the id? It's an important question, I think.
Good idea. The plasma craft are not based on any sort of technology, and they seem to be some sort of luminescent, I mean literally like a held together energy field. It's an entirely different energy and an entirely different story from the Pleiadians. Let me just get philosophical here for a second. The Pleiadians, on the one hand, seem to be what I call the people of the blue light. They seem to be very cold, you know, snotty tall guys, as you were saying.
Sure.
Very cold, very emotionless, very technologically driven. They drive machines. They seem very cold and very unemotional.
No wonder they like the Nazis.
Exactly. The Germans, the big tall blondes.
Yeah.
You know, the Nordics that supposedly that many of the Germans or the Caucasoid races are then descended from. Then on the other hand.
Yes, very quickly.
Okay, on the other hand, you have the plasma craft that seem to be very much in touch with the indigenous peoples, the American Indians, the Mexicans,
right.
A lot to
do with the environment, that kind of thing.
Yes, the ancient Mayans, and they are much more concerned with dominion rather than domination.
So maybe from the id, in other words, from within us.
Indeed.
Could be. All right. Sean David Morton is my guest. And there's much more, so stay right where you are. You're listening to the American CBC Radio Network. AMVIX 438, absolutely fresh flowers. Got something I've got to read here. Comes from Michael, friend of mine. Please ask Sean about December 5th, 1997. He's the person who began the rumor of the great opening on December 5th. At a UFO convention in November of 96, he said the following. One, that he was given exclusive permission by Zahi Hawass to film the opening of the chambers underneath the Sphinx, too. That there was an entryway at the front of the Sphinx that was being guarded, and from this entryway were coming the sounds of chanting. God, you remember Richard Hoagland said that? Three, that there were Japanese and German film crews, while drilling to place light poles in the ground, get this now, found five layers underneath the Sphinx. Upon reaching the bottom of the fifth layer, the diamond-headed drill was destroyed, hitting a surface harder than itself. Four, that he was going over early with Dr. Sherwood. He and the doctor were supposed to participate in what he called a chakra ritual down the Nile. This was in preparation for their possible entry into the guarded entryway. And five, lastly, he said Dr. Sherwood is able to predict the appearance of crop circle formations. Apparently, he predicted the date, location, and shape of the Julia crop circle in England. So, back to Sean David Morton. Sean, is that some of that true or none?
We've got our work cut out for us with all that.
Or none of it true. What's the deal?
Let me tell you what happened when we were in Egypt. The reason that I went there originally was because we had been approached specifically by some financiers who were interested in funding a major television project about a number of the new discoveries in Egypt. So
was that Mr. Shore?
No. As a matter of fact, Joseph Shore is a whole other story. And
All right. So it was somebody else.
Yes, but the people that for example, I met with Zahi Hawass. I met with the one of the directors of the Supreme Council of Antiquities. I met with I spent literally about 12 days on the plateau, scouring the plateau with various guides, with kids that I knew from when I went to school there back in 1975-76. And there's a lot of hogwash that's just coming out of Egypt now. I was there from December 16th until December 17th.
All right, fine. Let's take it point by point. You were given exclusive permission by Zahi Hawass to film the opening.
Okay. Originally, let me explain specifically. Okay, there was a numbers of sets of information that I was being given. The first set of information came from Dr. John Sherwood. We were given exclusive permission by Zahi Hawass specifically to film on the Giza Plateau. That was a confusion.
Okay, not the chambers beneath the Sphinx, at Giza.
There are chambers beneath the Sphinx. Let me tell you what there is, and I will tell you what the rumor is. When I originally went there, John Sherwood was basically telling people that he was going to that they had found this tunnel, that there was a door there specifically, and the reason there was all this hype about the door is because Zahi Hawass, a couple of years ago, had made a video in which he was standing in front of some sort of door at the end of a corridor, claiming that Indiana Jones would die to be here. What's on the other side of this door? Who can say? Who can tell? When I mentioned this to Zahi Hawass, he said it was just a publicity thing to get publicity for the opening of a number of tombs, one new tomb that they found actually just east of the Great Pyramid, and another entire set of about 65 tombs that are about 2,000 yards due east of the due south of the Sphinx itself.
All right, I'm going to tell you. Linda Moulton Howe interviewed Zahi Hawass.
Right.
And with respect to, was anybody going to open or look at anything? And other than a chamber that had been opened 20 years ago, he said, no, the rest of it is bull. Nothing is going to be open this year, nothing.
Absolutely correct.
That is correct.
Absolutely correct. Matter of fact, I was there inside the Great Pyramid on December 5th, and I can tell you that nobody opened a chamber, nobody opened a box. Nobody has any intention of opening any boxes. The area that was actually originally ultrasounded and drilled by the Japanese and the German crews over the last year or so has been completely paved over with about a $1 million project by the Egyptian government to push the cars and the various shops, because there were a lot of shops and cars that were obscuring the view of the Sphinx. They bought out an entire section of the little town of Mina, which is right near the Sphinx, tore it all out, tore it down, and then pushed everything back about 500 yards or so and put a huge concrete designed pavilion along with a rock wall. Now, Joseph Shore went over there, this is according to Hawass and everybody that I spoke to, and anybody can get rights to film and or shoot. And because they believe that the Gizeh Plateau does belong to the entire world, there are people out there shooting all
the time. That's on the outside, though.
Okay, on the outside and the inside the pyramid.
The main part of the pyramid.
Wherever. You can shoot all over the Gizeh Plateau with permission. But
right.
You move one rock, you pick up one rock, and you move it 5 inches wherever. That takes an entire series of permits that have to be filled out and approved, not just by Zahi Hawass, but also by the Supreme Council of Antiquities, which is a cabinet member that is directly appointed by President Mubarak. And you have to have the backing of a major university, you have to have funding, and you have to have a plan, which then has to be presented to the SCU.
All right, look, I'm going to let you in on what I know, the rumors that reached me. Now, here's what I heard. I heard, and there were internet rumors, that Zahi Hawass was transferred, kicked upstairs, away from Gizeh, and that there was going to be a decision to allow an opening. All of that turned out to be absolute baloney, nearly as I can tell.
Yeah, you're right. I was sitting in his office, 2 months ago. He's right where he's always been.
Okay.
The guy that was fired was the director of the Supreme Council of Antiquities, a guy named Amir Bakar, because he was, and there's been a lot of sneaky stuff going on with some antiquities theft. There were two kids that I talked to that turned in a gold statue about a year ago, and the kids were arrested, and they were taken to trial, and somebody stole the statue, and a wooden statue was put in its place.
Really?
Zahi was very much embarrassed when they presented 14 similar statues to the president, and somebody turned their back, and suddenly there were only 13 statues there. So there's a lot of people with sticky fingers running around Egypt. But as far as the chambers go, the ultrasounding has found a dead space, or in other words, an open area, in front of the Sphinx's paws, and also on the right shoulder of the Sphinx, there's a sort of a square chamber, and underneath that bedrock there's kind of a dead area there. Now, the only other space that's been found that was shown to me was in the Sphinx complex. There is a crack in the floor that was flooded because it was raining very, very hard. It was actually the first time Cairo had been flooded in, I think, 23 years or something while I was there. And they moved this big rock, and there was a sort of a crack in this part of the temple that you can only get in with a key and a special permit, and it was full of water. And they said, well, this is the only underground tunnel that they're going to be exploring and taking a look at. There was no, I mean, the rumors that I heard was that supposedly either on September 19th or December 5th, that they were going to open the door at the end of the star shaft of the Queen's Chamber, and that they opened it and found a statue of Louis Farrakhan or something that looked like Louis Farrakhan looking up at the star Sirius, and it was just all nonsense.
All right, well, that information came to Richard Hoagland from sources, supposedly good ones,
right,
at Gizeh, and you're saying it's not true.
No.
All right, second point. Richard Hoagland also said this. There was an entryway at the front of the Sphinx that was being guarded, and that from this entryway were coming the sounds of chanting. Not true or true?
Not true.
Not true.
No. The only space that I can tell you that's in front of the Sphinx is that when you jump up between the Sphinx's paws, and I actually snuck up there, well, I had a permit to go during the day, but I snuck up there at night.
What happens, by the way, if you get caught doing that?
Well, we did get caught, but, you give them a little backsheesh and they let you go. But
I see.
There's an area at the back of the Sphinx that's been cleared out. There's literally a hole right at sort of the sphincter of the Sphinx, right at where the tail is. It goes down about 12 feet, and this area has been cleared out because they've placed new steel reinforcing beams in the back of the new brickwork that they've just done at the back of the Sphinx.
Right.
In the front of the Sphinx, in between the paws, there's a hole. I mean, it's not a chamber. It's a hole that's about 4 feet by about 6 feet, and it's simply made up with there's like a grate there, and it's just all stuff that they... It's basically a hole that was made when they were doing the restoration on the paws. That's it.
Right. I've got some very, had highly detailed, and I'm sure they're still there, pictures of the Sphinx. And in front, between the paws, it looks like, there should be a sign that says under construction or something.
Right. Well, there's a scaffolding all along the left side of the Sphinx that they're working
right
in the back.
Right.
And then right between the paws, it's just a hole.
All right. Now, how do we know they've found, what's the... chamber business, five chambers under the sinks.
Well, as far as the chambering goes, supposedly the Japanese did, and they're not sharing information with anyone, so that's why I'm saying supposedly. The Japanese did a series of soundings around the area and did find some chambers underneath there. Now, as far as the drilling goes, they did hit something to the east of the plateau on three separate occasions, and there is something very, very hard about 30 feet down.
Now, the story here is that a diamond-headed drill broke.
That's true.
It's true?
Yep, they did drill down there, but the thing was that once they started drilling down and they hit something, the government made them stop. There's some very strange things going on.
What?
There's a lot of people right now, I might say Dr. Sherwood, I don't even want to call him doctor anymore, but this John Sherwood guy, we got in a huge fight with him because he's the one that was putting all the information out about there being this tunnel and this door and that he was going to open it. And it basically, there's just a whole lot of people leading a lot of tourists and a lot of seekers on sort of a merry path.
Sean, what could break a diamond-tipped drill?
Something harder than a diamond-tipped drill, obviously. Probably carbonite. I don't think it could be granite or any red granite that we know of. It would have to be some kind of material that would be...
What do we know about the geology of that area? Should that kind of material be present there?
No, it's all primarily limestone.
Exactly.
And as a matter of fact, they were sort of shocked when they found that the dead areas underneath the Sphinx might in fact be made out of a red granite substance. These stone boxes that they've found, the one that's sort of back towards the back of the Sphinx, it's sounding as though it's a very, very hard red granite. And of course, red granite has to be shipped in from Aswan, but it's what the whole interior of the King's Chamber inside Giza is made up of, the red granite. My prediction on this is that there, Zahi Hawass and the various Egyptian officials, the one biggest problem has been that I don't think anybody has gone about this right. We have the ARE, the Edgar Cayce Institute,
right,
has for many years wanted to prove the Edgar Cayce predictions about,
correct,
the Lost Library of Atlantis and the Hall of Records.
Yes.
Zahi Hawass has said that this is just American hallucinations.
Let me stop you there. He says a lot of things.
Yes.
Now, I know that you've got to maintain some sort of relationship, so you probably have to be careful of what you're saying. And if you do, tell me that so I know.
Okay.
What is your impression of Zahi Hawass, the man?
He was a wonderfully nice man. He's well-respected by the people that work for him. In Egypt, he's controversial. Some people, love him.
And some don't.
Other people hate him. None of the people that I met hated him. All the people that I saw who worked there and worked for him were devoted to the guy. He's a wonderfully nice man. He's like, everybody's sort of Egyptian papa.
Graham Hancock, though, and Robert Bivol, they are not exactly Zahi's favorite guys.
No.
As a matter of fact, it was said that Zahi said, should they show up, he will dig a pit, throw them in, tear their heads off, and urinate upon them.
Well, they...
In other words, it didn't sound like he was real happy with them. Now, what's going on there?
Well, Graham said some very harsh things in his book about Zahi. Specifically, Graham Hancock and Bivol wrote The Message of the Sphinx.
Yes,
and
I
also
know.
The Boris Said. Zahi did not feel as though he was well represented to be Boris Said piece that they did for NBC, which was also called Message of the Sphinx, or Mystery of the Sphinx, I'm sorry. And, Zahi had theories that were directly opposite to the theories that they were presenting, and he was given, like 10 seconds in the entire documentary, and basically made to look sort of like a buffoon, which is what, which was what they didn't appreciate. You also have to remember, too, that their entire attitude is, look, you can't hurt the Sphinx, you can't hurt the pyramid. They belong to the world. The minute you get a bunch of crazy Americans going in there, they get heat in the German press, in the British press, all over the world. There was a big controversy about opening that door at the end of the star shaft. They sent the Upanaut up there.
Yes.
To see the door.
Yes.
But that's kind of where it stops, because that German scientist, from Ingolstadt University, he only had the permit to do filming. Not, and what they were planning on doing was when they couldn't figure out how to open this thing, he wanted to, like, blow it up. I mean, literally, like, blow a hole in it with explosives. And that's when they said, look, you need
the antiquities to... people are not going to go for that
exactly.
One.
And so you have to find a way. And this is what we're trying to do. Now, Joseph Shore went over there last April, ran around doing what it was he was doing. And then
he started doing
things that he didn't have a permit to do.
All right, which was what? What was he ostensibly allowed to do?
Basically film. I mean, let me tell you the things that they have found. The things that they have found that are probably the most interesting right now is that they have found the base of what appears to be a fourth pyramid on the Giza Plateau, a very, very large pyramid, the base for it. They found a new solar boat. By the smallest of the three pyramids.
Wait a minute. A fourth pyramid with only the base and the rest of it missing?
Yes, just the base. Just the base. They found...
Do you think that means that that's all they constructed, or that there was a pyramid there at one time and the rest of it is gone?
I don't know. They consider it just to be the base of a pyramid that never got built.
Wow. Sean, hold on. We're at the bottom of the hour. Fascinating, fast-paced material coming at you. So make yourself comfortable. It's obviously going to be an interesting evening. My guest is Sean David Morton. I'm Art Bell, and this is CBC.
Stay tuned for more of the absolute best of Art Bell, right after a word from your local sponsors.
Four, six, two, seven. All right, back now to Sean David Morton. Sean, so they're able to see a very high-definition photograph now of the Sphinx. This has fascinated me all of my life. I have wanted to go and see it. Finally, I'm going to be able to in October, along with a bunch of other people. My question to you is, what do you recommend for those who go to see the Sphinx and the pyramids?
Well, you definitely have to go take the camel ride.
the camel ride, yes.
They have camels and horses. There's a gentleman there by the name of Antonio who has the Abulcel. There's a series of stables that are sort of right there in the Mina village where you can jump on these very spirited Arabian horses and they'll just flail off like Indiana Jones off through the backside of the desert, because they take you into the desert onto the various mounds, which they still haven't really done any investigations on yet. These mounds to the direct southern edge of the pyramids. That's great fun. And then, of course, taking the entire tour that goes into all the pyramids. You should probably do Mykerinos, the smallest one, first, because Mykerinos represents the father or the male energy, and then Khafre, which is the second one, represents the mother or the female energy, and then of course the third one, the Great Pyramid of Giza, is the masculine or sun energy, going down into the pit first and then going into the queen's chamber. And of course the legend is you can make a wish in the queen's chamber and it will come true, because it's supposed to be the path of material reality. And then of course up into the grand gallery, into the king's chamber there. Let me mention one thing, Art, too. I wanted to be able to mention the newsletter, if I may, please.
Oh, you may. The newsletter is primarily prophecy, isn't it?
Well, it's a little bit of everything. The reason I called it the Delphi Associates as well is because I wanted to be able to take not only my research, but the psychic information and a lot of the Nostradamus decoding that we're doing with myself and my buddy and partner down in San Diego, Robert Egan, want to say hi to. And... for example, in just this last newsletter that we published February 17th, we've had 19 major hits in the newsletter. For example, predicted the freak tornadoes in Arkansas, the death of Deng Xiaoping, the...
You did. When did you predict these?
This was February 17th. Just to give you an example just of what you've been talking about.
Boy, those are hits. All right.
Just what you've been talking about tonight is that we were talking about the Redbacks and the big money exchange. May 1st of 1995, in issue 19, I was talking about watching for the money exchange in that they would change the $100 bills first, which would come in the spring of 96, and then that a much larger money exchange would happen in 1997.
Mm-hmm.
Just looking at the newsletter here already, some of the hits that we've had, I predicted that cloning coming out of the United Kingdom, first with farm animals, and the next progression of the cloning is going to be that they're going to start cloning organs first, not whole people, but organs like a heart and a liver and a kidney.
Right.
They're going to be able to clone those so you can actually sort of have an extra heart waiting in the freezer somewhere so that you can get it transplanted, which will be the next giant step in genetics so that they don't have to use very, very expensive immune-suppressing drugs. I already know a doctor actually down in Texas who's doing this now, but it's going to be the next big thing that comes down. I've also a major prediction about the what's going on with China with these two gentlemen, Hung and Trey, and how I do believe that it's going to be the China crisis and the Democratic National Committee taking all this money from Red China that finally is going to bring old Big Bad Bill down and at least bring it to a full hearing in the House and the Senate. So it's And also, we have a major interview with Audrain, a 22-page interview with Audrain that was the first time the case was ever broken. So for those who want to get the Delphi Associates newsletter, get out your pencils. The number you can call for information is 310-217-7579. That's 310-217-7579.
What hours?
Anytime. It's a service that'll have the information about how to get the newsletter and the subscription rates and all that. For people that want to subscribe, it's $50 a year for a 12-issue subscription. It checks out to PRI, which is the Prophecy Research Institute. We publish the Delphi Associates newsletter. And mail any checks that you might have to 2207 Hermosa Avenue. That's 2207 Hermosa Avenue, H-E-R-M-O-S-A. And that's in Hermosa Beach, California, 90254. And once again, the phone number is 310-217-7579, and for those of you listeners that want to get the newsletter about Audrain, it's an issue called The Man Who Fell to Earth. You can order the Volume 3, which is the back issues of the newsletters. We've got all the issues all very handsomely bound, so anybody can go all the way back to Issue 1 when I started doing this all the way back in 1993, all the way up to the present.
All right.
Thank you for letting me make the plug there.
Absolutely. Melissa in Las Vegas says, Dear Art, thank you for bringing Sean on the show. Ask him to talk about his experience when he spent the night in the Great Pyramid.
Oh, goodness. Well, that was a long time ago. When I was a kid, my stepfather had an import-export business, and we were the first wave of Americans actually into Egypt. After Nasser died and Sadat took over and began to turn away from Russia and open up to the West. So those were the days when really Cairo was great. You could run up and down the pyramid. There were still fakirs and holy men who knew all the mysteries of where things were and understood. I mean, I literally had this old Hebrew holy man take me through the pyramid when I was about 15 years old and show me all the prophecies and all of the masonry of the pyramids and what all the angles meant. And on three separate occasions, a buddy of mine from school, his brother was one of the guards up on the Giza Plateau, and we wanted to spend the night in the pyramid. So the first night he let us in, and we ran around, and we heard a lot of very strange noises, and there were some odd things going on, and we first thought that his brother had snuck back in just to scare us. The second time we went in there, we were so terrified that we were literally hanging on the gate screaming for people to let us out. And the third time, I actually spent the night in the sarcophagus, and I had a vision of this being, the Anubis, this huge 7-foot-tall, copper-skinned, dog-headed man who pointed at me and literally took me in this vision that I had through the pyramid to show me not only... And it was very strange because he took me through these different spheres that were different colors and had... different like animals and angels and demons all through the spheres, and it took me almost another 20 years to figure out that what he was showing me was the layout of the Hebrew Kabbalah and how the Kabbalah actually related to all of the time codings and the prophecies and the stars that all directly coincide with the Great Pyramid. And a large number of the prophecies and predictions that the pyramid is talking about are literally coming up in the next 3 years.
Sean, what is the purpose of the pyramids?
It's a gigantic clock. It's literally a prophecy in stone. It is a way to show that mankind spiritually fell sometime around 2500 BC. It's actually, I think, 2562 is the exact date. And the pyramid is shaped like a tomb because it shows mankind's spiritual journey through darkness. And in this, there are three paths. And the paths, and of course, you know, you would probably know better than anybody how these three paths work, is that the one path goes, the mass of humanity continues to go down and down and down into the pit, into the hopeless area. A big chunk of humanity really doesn't care. They're just sort of, you know, they just want their things. They want their stuff. They're more materialistically oriented, and they move into the path of the Queen's Chamber. And then there's a smaller group, a bright group of light workers that are actually all moving upwards towards Godhead, literally towards ascension. And those are the group that actually are moving upwards towards the Grand Gallery and eventually towards the King's Chamber. And, of course, the representative is the sarcophagus, which is empty, represents mankind's final conquest of death sometime in around 3000 A.D.
So we're going to miss it.
Well, no, we're going to be here. It's just a question of how we're going to then reincarnate. We're part of this group of souls that incarnates in mass. It's very much a transmigration of souls that is moving upwards. And the two specific dates that are coming up is from 1985 to 1999 are basically a blank space. And one of the things that I learned is that there are no prophecies or predictions, that literally mankind is shaping reality. In 1985, and this was just as Halley's Comet was visible from the Earth, the statement, if you understand the geometry, is that powerful spiritual influences will begin to irradiate the enlightened, bringing them closer to spiritual and material perfection. That began in 85 with the God force literally becoming physically manifest. That then ends on February 12th of 1999, where it says that, and it simply states, the kingdom of heaven comes to earth. And this is if you understand, once again, the angles. Now, the constellation of Orion is going to be directly above, in other words, at a meridian point, directly above the Great Pyramid on May 5th, of 2000.
Which is also the alignment of the planets.
Of the planets. And the last time this happened was 2500 B.C., and the last time it happened before that was 10,500 B.C.
All right. You know about remote viewers?
Yes.
You know of Ed Dames?
Yes, I do.
He tells me, as do others, by the way, that somewhere out in just about the timeline you're speaking about, he sees nothing. Nothing beyond that, what he calls a discontinuity, that there is going to be some sort of large spiritual event that will affect all of mankind, which he calls a discontinuity. He doesn't really exactly know what it is, but he knows it's there.
And what year does he see this happening?
He sees this happening, it seems to me, right around just past the turn of the century. I'm trying to recall exactly what he said, but the dates are close. Any thoughts on that?
No, because I see humanity progressing beyond then. I do see...
He doesn't say they won't. He says there is some massive spiritual event that's going to occur.
I would agree with that, and I think it has to do with 1999. I think a lot of it... I think you're going to see a major bulk of the Earth changes. We're talking about the earthquakes, and a lot of the massive stuff that's going to occur is going to occur between February and probably June of 1998. It fits in with a number of cycles as far as the United States goes, a number of planetary cycles, a number of astrological cycles. And I'm not exactly sure what the kingdom of heaven means. Does it mean that it's a spiritual place, that people finally learn how to become free and independent, individual? Do they stop listening to all the crap and all the malarkey that's being rammed down their throats by, you know, the major media and the governments and people constantly lying to them? Do they just start giving that up? And do they start coming out of the cities? I mean, my theory is they start literally coming out of the cities and starting to legitimately, for the first time, really forming these spiritual communities, because I see a 40-year period between 1999 and the year 2039 that I call the second Exodus. And it's very much like the Hebrews that are being led out of Egypt that had to forget being slaves and serving the Egyptian gods and learn how to be free again and worship God and understanding that the Lord is their shield and their strength. And then it took the next generation to take the promised land because they knew how to be free and live responsibly.
And what do you think is going to drive this? Any idea?
I think it's going to be the collapse of material civilization. I mean, I literally think that it's going to be sort of an implosion, not only of the material economic system that we have now, the end of, I guess, you know, the petroleum-based oil structures, a true information revolution, a true revolution as far as energy goes that's going to individualize a lot of what's going on.
That's already occurring to some degree. I heard CNN reported earlier tonight that the figures on the Internet, this web of interconnectivity we now have in the world, I don't know, something like it doubled or tripled in the last month or month and a half or something. Astronomical numbers. The Internet is almost a living thing. It's headed that way.
Exactly. And look at it this way, Art. Look at what it is you do. You are literally connecting a universal mind. We're talking about the cell phones and the fax machines and the computers and the Internet,
right,
that are literally creating a universal group consciousness,
right,
that is the kindergarten for telepathy.
Well, maybe it's good and maybe it isn't, Sean. Michael Crichton, in his latest book, writes that there is a possibility, and you must consider the possibility, that this information web that is now developing at an out-of-control rate will actually slow the process of evolution because ideas will not independently develop. You know, the same top 10 ideas will be thought of in Kenya as they are in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that it's a... do you think that the mass of human knowledge actually doubling or tripling every couple of years or so, that if one person comes up with the idea and another person comes up with the idea, that maybe those two people working together can actually realize that idea much more quickly?
Maybe. Maybe. I'm not sure which is true. I kind of lean toward, you know, the positive view of the interconnectivity.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not positive.
Well, I guess obviously the downside is that one, if one is telepathic, then one begins to become sort of like a hive mind. You become like bees or ants or, I don't know, the gray bees or something, where you begin to lose your individuality and individual forms of thought by constantly sharing a group consciousness. So, I mean, that's the downside to it, is that we're bombarded by other people's thoughts and ideas and opinions, and eventually does that kill emotion?
That's right. He backs it up by suggesting if you take a very few birds and put them on an uninhabited island, they will very, very quickly evolve in many ways,
mm-hmm,
because they must. But if you put gazillions of birds on an island, they will not quickly evolve. The process will be very, very slow. So
they form structures.
That's correct.
They basically form structures which are much, much harder to break and function. And I think that that's what a lot of what's going to happen is the breaking up globally of governments and structures. And that's why things like, you know, the Delphi Associates newsletter that I work on, why your show is so important, why all of these things, because we're attacking the structures. In a lot of these ways, we're breaking down the old things that don't work, but we have to come up with something else together that literally is going to replace those old structures. And I think that that's what the primary point of what we're going to see is going to be about. Now, 2012 is important because there's a military report which is called the Flight of the Key Bird. And what they did is that they were doing mapping somewhere around in the early part of 1945, and then all the way up through the 1960s, where they were saying that electromagnetic north was jumping. And in this military report, they were saying that if electromagnetic north jumps to a point of where it hits true north, that there is the possibility of a electromagnetic polar shift. Not a physical polar shift, but an electromagnetic polar shift.
Understood.
And if the electromagnetic polar shift does occur, that what will happen is, and literally their projection of this occurring is between 2010 and about 2014, everything that's connected to a ground wire, every computer, every electrical device, everything will fry and be unusable. And it literally will have, not only will it cause winds of several hundred miles an hour, causing the jet stream to actually dip down onto the ground, but according to this report, they were saying that it's completely going to put it in sort of wild terms, erase the human brain. I mean, literally confuse the electrical structures of the brain, so people will have sort of a mass corporate amnesia. So it's... it just depends on which future that you want to pick. I mean, I'm in the middle, where I've been saying ever since I started doing this that I still think that mankind has that ineffable ability to actually step to the edge and step to the brink, look into the abyss, and then step back and say, no thanks, I don't want to go there, and begin to fix things and fix problems. And I do think that that's what's going to happen.
Are some very bright timelines inevitable, unavoidable,
yes.
Absolute?
Yes. I think the global consciousness is inevitable, absolute. I think that the right now, the Antichrist character that Nostradamus talks about, quite so much in his quatrains, I don't see anything diffusing that. Some grand Islamic leader that eventually links Iran and Iraq and those two countries then coming together, then forming the Islamic Jihad, the entire Islamic Republic. The timeline we're on is we'll see the rise of Islam and the eventual destruction, or should I say decay, of the Western nations, specifically Europe. And I do still think that there's going to be a major, major global conflict between the Islamic nations and the United States. We haven't done anything to avert that timeline. If anything, the Clinton administration and the Israelis are just exacerbating it.
I understand. All right. Stay right where you are. Sean David Morton is my guest. Intrigued? Yeah, I bet. Stay right where you are. We will be back. This is CBC.
To purchase all...
Cautionary word, there is news breaking at this hour that our president, President Clinton, is in the hospital. The initial reports are that it is nothing more than a sprained or injured ankle, some kind of problem with his ankle. Now, after many, many years of talk radio, I want to caution you that a lot of what you hear when a president goes to the hospital, and this may be absolutely accurate, but a lot of what you hear is absolute bull. And generally, if a president has a serious medical condition, they don't tell you about it. That's just a caution. I've learned that over the years. So the top of the news was the president apparently is hurt or injured in some way. His ankle. That is the story they're giving out at the moment. As it develops, we'll let you know, because we are here live while others repeat regurgitated, recycled, relentless, regurgitated stuff from yesterday or the day before or whatever. We're here live so we can report this kind of thing, and we will track it throughout the night with you. So bear with me on that, and we'll find out what we can as we can. Back now to my guest, Sean David Morton. Sean.
Yes, sir.
The photographs, a couple of which, anyway, that you have given to us and we've put up on the website right now, of these incredible ships, also came into the possession of Randolph Winters.
Mm-hmm. Actually, Randy was originally how we met Audrain down in Miami.
Oh, so he introduced you.
He was the original contact, yeah.
I see. And then you've got a couple that I have not seen before, and so they're the same source.
Yes, same gentleman, and it's as I said, Randy was our original contact with Audrain down in Miami. So we first flew down with Randy to meet Audrain about, well, I guess it was May of last year.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably originally how some of those photographs were released. And I'm not sure if Randy has a photograph or two on his website or not.
All right. Everybody wants to... here's what I want to cover, if I can.
Okay.
Earth changes. They are a-coming. I call it the quickening. It is social, political. In every area of life, the environment, the economy, socially, every area, politically, you name it, things are quickening. They're happening faster. They're more severe. They're more extreme. We're obviously headed for something, and a lot of people think it's going to be Earth changes, and I know you've got prophecy regarding Earth changes, and everybody wants timelines. They want to know what's going to happen and when.
Easy for them to say.
That's right.
Well, one of the things that that I've been particularly good at is that, and one of the reasons why I started printing the Delphi Associates newsletter originally was so that I could have some printed forum to show people that, well, here it is, it's in black and white, this is what I've said, And this is the process. I've been on dozens of television shows here in Los Angeles.
I know.
From predicting months in advance the Northridge quake. I actually predicted the exact epicenter and magnitude of the quake. I missed the exact date of the quake by less than 10 days. I said it was going to occur between December 25th and January 7th, and it actually happened on the 17th. And I literally had people calling me, like, threatening to kill me because I'd said that, well, you know, because I put it out on my answering machine, I'm saying, look, this thing is coming. You guys have to be ready. I'm feeling it. I'm sick. It's running all the way up and down my back. And but let's talk about some of the stuff that's going to go on in the
future.
Well,
all right, we'll get to that. How did you feel it? I presume you've seen...
Wait a minute.
Have you seen the motion picture prop... Or, oh, darn.
A phenomenon.
Thank you.
It was funny because I went to go see it with some friends of mine, and they're looking at me going, are they following you around?
All right. Well, that's what I meant. Is that what you felt, what was described there, a kind of a low-frequency... I don't know.
Well, before the Northridge quake...
Nauseating.
There was a lot of very peculiar things about the Northridge quake. I live in Hermosa Beach, and I mean, my whole house was literally buzzing. The windows in my house were literally rattling for about 10 days or so before this whole thing happened. You know, the ocean was very, very active. I was getting massive nausea, and a lot of times this earthquake phenomenon will manifest in the lower back, in the sciatic nerve, because you're literally picking up radio frequencies that are coming up through the feet and causing lower back pains. Or specifically very, very severe headache pains, usually around the ridge of the right eye is how I particularly feel them, and I've noticed other people who are sensitive to this also feel them. I also work with a group of people, other people who are sensitive to this phenomenon as well, so all of us kind of keep in touch whenever we're getting these types of feelings.
Right.
I might also point out also that a small group of individuals who know what they are doing, who know how to pray, who know how to meditate, who know how to drive this energy down into the planet, have often, on many, many occasions, been able to avert or greatly lessen various catastrophes. There's a very famous quote by Edgar Cayce where he says that there are those conditions that in the activity of individuals in the line of thought and endeavor oft keep many a city and many a land intact through their association of the spiritual laws and their associations with other like-minded individuals.
Hmm.
So, for example, one of the major things that I predicted last year for San Francisco was that I said to watch the window for April 18th to May 20th, that there was going to be a major quake on April 18th, another quake in between that time and May 20th, and then I also felt that there were going to be substantial quakes in San Francisco in October. Right on the 18th, I mean, to the day, there was a 4.5 and a 4.1. And then on May 21st, there was a 4.9 and a 4.7. These are the largest quakes that San Francisco had had in 6 years, since the Loma Prieta quake. Now, a way for Northern California energy to be diffused, specifically, there is a vortex, or literally a chakra point, at Mount Shasta in Northern California.
Mm-hmm.
And prayer work and energy work that's done at Mount Shasta controls that area. This is my personal belief because I've seen it happen. This area of Northern California, and in Southern California, the actual vortex point is in downtown Los Angeles at the gazebo on Alvera Street, and because there's so many people actually absorbing energy off that vortex, you have to go offshore to the Channel Islands, specifically to a place called Scorpion Ranch on Santa Cruz Island, and there, energy by like-minded individuals who are doing prayer can literally act upon the planet, because the planet is a living organism, which is what we're finding out now, and that small groups of human beings can literally act like acupuncture needles, like a very tiny needle that's stuck into the human body that then regenerates energy to that particular area. So there were about 2,000 people up in Mount Shasta in May that were up there for some huge spiritual conference in which all of them were praying and sending energy into this mountain. And the earthquakes that I saw for San Francisco, and I was talking about a substantial quake that I thought was going to occur in October, very minor quakes, you know, 3.5, I think there was like a 4.2.
Right.
Of course, they got hit with all the water, you know, and of course, the flooding that's been happening up there is causing more damage than any earthquake ever could.
Yes.
So this is primarily how it works. I mean, a lot of what I'm seeing in the most recent newsletter now has a lot to do with the freak winds. A year ago, I wrote a specific, this was in February of 90.
Tell you, 100 mile an hour winds in Hawaii, the Big Island. 100 mile an hour winds off the coast of California and Oregon this year. Winds that nobody's ever seen or rarely have ever been seen in Ohio through Pennsylvania and New York.
Right.
Massachusetts with 100 mile an hour winds. What the hell is going on?
Well, part of it was a major prediction that we had in the newsletter because we tore apart a Nostradamus quatrain that talked about the Hale-Bopp comet. And that at the time, my prediction was is that when the Hale-Bopp comet came by, when we first started seeing it, which was late November, early part of December, when it was actually visible,
right,
that this would be specifically a period of massive flooding, that there would be catastrophes all across the United States, and that quite specifically that they would be massive winds. Now, some of these winds are actually being caused by the breakup of the Northern Ice Shelf. Now, my prediction was that there would be three comets, this prediction was made in January of 96.
And we've had a Hayakazaki.
That there would be three comets that would come before Hale-Bopp.
Right.
And that what would happen with Hale-Bopp is that Hale-Bopp, and this is in the newsletter in January of 96, that Hale-Bopp would begin to break up. That literally the ruin of this comet would occur. And either this was going to occur with the comet beginning to fracture into pieces or the comet crashing into the sun. And at the same time, there would be great catastrophes as far as weather was concerned and also financial catastrophes as well. Now, the interesting thing also about Hale-Bopp, and you've had so much information on this on the web, so
that's right.
Please correct me if I'm incorrect on this. But when I spoke to my friends at the Griffith Observatory, they said that the Hale-Bopp comet was very interesting because they said it was a carbon monoxide-based comet, which meant that this comet, instead of just being ice, had a carbon monoxide makeup, which meant that when the comet was going to come by, that the comet was going to glow a very bright bluish color, which relates directly to the Hopi prophecies of the blue star
Kachina.
That so many people have been talking
the
about.
The blue Kachina.
And the Hopi said that this would be the last great warning to mankind would be this blue star. Now, of course, the prediction played itself out with Hayakitake, which was the first comet, and I was expecting actually two more, but then, and like I said, correct me if I'm wrong on this, I believe Hale-Bopp has actually broken into two other pieces that have actually have two small companions on either side of the comet.
There have been photographs showing something like that. Alan Hale the other night claimed, though, that was an artifact of the photograph. So I don't know.
I jokingly said that in the newsletter on March 29th of 96 that we get to, since I was predicting these two smaller comets, that we could call them Sean and David. So take a little credit here for something. Everything seems to be coming together. I mean, the pyramid prophecies and predictions, many of the prophecies of Nostradamus, the Hopi prophecies, obviously pointing to some great massive change. Now I see history as a period of cycles, and like, for example, the one cycle we're going through now is Uranus is now moving through the constellation of Aquarius. The last time that happened was from 1912 to 1920. Well, look at the global changes that occurred in just those 8 years, where we had the origination of the IRS, the 16th Amendment, the Federal Reserve, Prohibition, the First World War, a massive Spanish influenza epidemic that killed some 25 million people globally. And we're actually having that same very interesting pattern begin to repeat itself now, where I believe that with this president, Clinton, who, and it's not a question of if he's going to be removed from office, it's just a question of when. Every president that we've ever had take the oath of office in what's called a void of course moon, astrologically, which means when the moon is actually moving between two astrological signs, without fail, has either been impeached or killed while in office. Nixon in 73, Kennedy in 1961. It goes all the way back to the beginning of the Republic that everybody that takes the oath either it dies in office. And my scenario from this, from the beginning of when he was elected, was two things. Either Gore and Clinton go down with the China controversy, which is kind of interesting because, and please correct me on my civics on this, if the president and vice president actually are removed from office, doesn't that make the secretary of state the third person in line?
No, Speaker of the House.
Oh, the Speaker of the House. So it is Newt Gingrich.
Mm-hmm.
The second aspect of this is that if Clinton does in fact step down and Gore steps up, it has been my prediction for many years that it would be Jay Rockefeller who would then become the Vice President of the United States. And then something would then happen to Gore, and Jay Rockefeller, then under the influence of Lawrence Rockefeller, would then have something to do with the federal bankruptcy. And that bankruptcy would then consolidate the Rockefellers' power over the United States, Canada, and South America, which has a lot to do with the new currency.
So you see a gigantic financial crisis ahead.
With the implosion of the stock market, that's very likely. And, of course, that would then be used as an excuse to renew the currency, because what they want to do is now bankrupt Canada so they can have one currency literally from pole to pole, all the way up to the North Pole to the South Pole, and they would all be Federal Reserve notes. Pretty frightening, eh?
Yeah, pretty frightening is right.
And, of course, now they're introducing the ECU, the European currency in Europe. By the way, if you have some of your listeners, this would be a fascinating thing to actually put on your website. Have you actually seen the design for the European currency unit?
No, I have not. I'd love to.
The design on the unit, and I've got one laying around here someplace, so if I can actually put this bill and scan it in and send it over to you. But literally, the design, I mean, it makes your skin crawl, Art, when you see this, because the design on this is it's a reddish sort of hue. And it's got what appears to be like a lion or some kind of creature that's actually leaping out of the ocean. And this lion has 7 heads, and there are 10 horns on the heads.
Really?
And it has a woman in red holding a torch riding on the back of this lion. Well, that's right out of Revelation 12. I mean, it's the same thing. It's the beast with the 7 heads and the 10 horns with the scarlet whore of Babylon who's riding upon its back, and it's on the back of the money. And these people are basically saying to us, we're going to do it to you, see if you can stop us. And not only see if you can stop us, we're going to put it right, we're going to slap you in the face with this, with your own symbology, to show you exactly what it is we have planned. And you try and stop us. You can see if you can.
Does it have to happen?
Does it have to happen?
Yeah.
No. Might it happen? This is how I view history is that it's sort of like a massive college, and the college is that everybody comes in for their classes, and let's say we all meet up in freshman orientation, and we go off, and you become a radio announcer, and I become a writer, and, you know, we do all these different things, but we then have to meet back in the classes that are required. We have to take Spanish or English or a science or mathematics, and so there are certain classes that humanity signs up to take, and we can either create these classes in such a way where we incarnate for a very specific reason.
Right.
And incarnating for this reason is that we have to take these classes. Now, when you look at these world leaders, like a Mao or a Stalin or a Hitler, on the personal level, they seem very harsh, and of course they're brutal, and they kill and murder and maim millions of people. On the other level, on the spiritual level, when you look at people who are actually, when you look at them as unkillable, immortal souls, you might look at them, I almost hate to say this, in the same aspect as the teacher that you hated in high school, but who made you learn your lessons. He was the math teacher. That
I remember that. All right, Sean, hold on. We're at the bottom of the hour. We're going to find out about Sean's hit rate when we come back and see what he sees for our future. What do you say? I'm Art Bell, and this is CBC.
Her hair is hollow gold. Her lips sweet surprise. Her hands are never cold. She's got Betty Davis eyes. She's got her music on you. You won't have to think twice.
Stay tuned for more of Art Bell's interview with Sean David Morton on Egypt on this encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell. Is taking a well-deserved night off. He'll return to the airwaves live for Dreamland this Sunday and Coast to Coast AM Monday night, Tuesday morning. Tonight, Chancellor Broadcasting presents from March 13th Art's riveting 5-hour interview with Prophet Sean David Morton and his latest insights on Egypt. And now, the best of Art Bell.
If you're over 40 and would like to feel 20 again, which is really a silly question, then you might want to pay attention to me very closely. Now, a recent cover of Newsweek magazine referred to the all-natural hormone, DHEA, as the fountain of youth. That was Newsweek. Why? Because DHEA interacts with about 50 other hormones in your body, a key to youthful vigor. It's really quite simple. Just put back the hormones into your body that were there when you're 20. Remember that?
Zone and 2 a.m. to 7 a.m. in the Eastern. Art Bell's Dreamland can be heard live Sunday nights, 7 to 10 in the Pacific Time Zone and 10 p.m. to 1 a.m. in the Eastern. Please contact your local radio listings to confirm the exact times Art Bell airs live in your area. And now, Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Anyway, it's great to be here, and it's even great to bring you the next message, and that is about flowers. In Florida, with what the White House says, right emphasis there, is a minor injury, an ankle injury, they believe. And they're not even sure about that. They say, though, the injury is minor. Now, let me give you a small caveat here, and that is that when it comes to the health of presidents, they lie. I'm not saying they're lying, and I'm not saying this is more than a minor injury, because I don't know that to be the case at all. Not at all. I just know that they lie. So keep that in the back of your mind as you listen to the reports as they develop over the next several hours. And we'll just kind of keep that in mind. My guest is Sean David Morton. The program is electrifying. There are a lot of specific details and prophecies that are being made. The information has been of a great volume and great interest. And a lot of people want a copy of the program. So please write down the phone number. You can call it 24 hours a day. If it is busy now, you call it later. This applies to any guests I have, or to ordering the newsletter, whatever. It's kind of the utility number. It's 1-800-917-4278. And if you would just please write it down, you will save me great amounts of headache. That's 1-800-917-4278. Do you know how many people want a cell phone but can't? 10, 50. Find out how it can be part of your IRA or retirement account. It's opportunity knocking again. 1-800-444-1050. Back now to Sean David Morton. And Sean, we have talked a little bit about earth changes, and there's some whoppers coming, but you don't see the Gordon Michael Scallion cracking up and falling off of California and all the rest of it. What do you see?
Well, no, I don't see that. Absolutely no way, no how. What I do see is that I see more has to do with the flooding, the changing of seaports, the one major area that I do see just being pounded over and over and over again, especially later this year, is going to be the Florida area with some major evacuations in Miami, in St. Petersburg, all across the lower part of Florida.
Really?
Primarily from the winds, from these hurricanes that I see just lining up, you know, six major ones, just bing, bang, boom, all the way down.
Why is this happening?
The one thing I think has something to do with it, the winds are getting very erratic. I think it has a lot to do with the breaking up of the north and south poles. This massive influx of fresh water that is changing the salination, actually, of the ocean is what is actually causing a lot of this the freak wind and the freak damage that's going on.
You know about the Larsen ice shelf in Antarctica?
I just I did a big piece on it, actually, in the newsletter just this month about the Larsen ice shelf, and the biggest problem with it is that we are conceivably, and there are two schools of thought on this. The one school of thought is that when the Larsen Ice Shelf goes, and of course there are glacial volcanoes that are now going off, not only in Iceland, mm-hmm. but then at the South Pole as well, that's actually beginning to melt the polar ice caps. There are one group of geologists who believe that, well, you know, the polar ice caps are really no big deal, that they make up less than maybe, you know, 2% of the landmass of the planet, and if they all melted away, that maybe nothing would happen, at least as far as the spin, at the centrifugal force of the spin of the planet goes. Another school of thought of this, of course, is that once the polar ice caps begin to break up, we have a biblical version of the apocalypse, which is literally the wobble of the Earth increasing, so that literally the stars and the sun weave like a drunkard in the sky, I believe, as it says in the Book of Revelation somewhere.
Nice.
The biggest threat is actually these gigantic winds, because the polar ice caps and, of course, the salinization in this actually have a direct effect on the jet streams. And the way the jet streams are being pulled down, we're actually literally facing a possibility of the jet streams actually striking the Earth. I mean, literally coming down in pockets on the Earth with wind speeds of several hundred miles an hour for brief periods of time. And, of course, then the next biggest problem with all this introduction of fresh water is the destruction of a great deal of marine life. And of course, everything lives off the plankton and the various zooplankton that the whales and everything else lives off of. And then these gigantic holes that are opening up in the ozone layer. One big thing for specifically Los Angeles in the Southern California area is that I think that you're going to see a very, very large ozone pocket open up over Los Angeles and the western part of the lower southwestern part of the United States, Arizona and Nevada, where there's really going to be nowhere to run. These power outages that you're seeing all across the planet are also occurring because it's not inexplicably, it could also be because of the explosion of various nuclear weapons that have actually knocked the Earth off of its orbit, slightly out of kilter. This wobble is actually making the electrical frequency of the planet jump. Now, we have something called the Schumann resonance, which is everything is connected to a ground wire. When we went with the whole J.P. Morgan Edison, lighting and power system, I'm sure your listeners are most familiar with, when Tesla said, well, gee, we can have free power that we can just bring up out of the planet, and J.P. Morgan said, well, so you're telling me any idiot can put an antenna up in his yard and have free power? Where's the money in that? We now have an artificial electrical system that's approximately 60 cycles. Well, the actual planet functions ideally at about 7.83. Now, that jumped last year to was fluxing between 7.83 to about 8.5, and then on June 22nd of last year, it jumped almost 9.1, and directly after that, you had all these power grids that started going out in the western United States, because the power grids have to be connected to the Schumann resonance. That's going to jump again to probably about 9.5 to maybe almost 10, and this is going to continue to fry dynamos and start fires all across the western United States. Of course, at the same time that we're having these mass heat waves all across the Midwest, because you're going to see fluctuations in temperature of nearly 100 degrees, in other words, literally going from 50 below to 50 to 60 above within the space of maybe 2 to 3 weeks. We don't have a spring anymore. It just it's going to go from the middle of winter into the middle of summer all of a sudden, and of course all that snow is going to melt. I think that probably one of the biggest catastrophes that's going to happen in American history is going to occur sometime in late 1998, and this is going to once again have to do with the Midwest, and I think the cracking of the New Madrid Fault, and that's going to be the biggest thing that we're going to have to look for. California is relatively calm, and in my opinion, California doesn't really have the geological basis to have 9.3 quakes, because we have a major fault line that has a series of smaller fault lines or faultines that literally act as shock absorbers for the quakes that we have in California. The New Madrid Fault is two gigantic chunks of granite that have really no release whatsoever, all just pounding against each other. And there was actually a ringing of the New Madrid Fault when we had the big earthquake down in Peru that was several hundred miles down. This was the one that was the 8.4 that was actually ringing bells in Toronto that went all the way up that crack and then went all the way up the center part of the United States. I think that is going to be where the biggest catastrophe in the U.S. is going to be, is the fracturing of that fault. And at that point, with the climate changing, you're going to actually see areas like Alaska and Canada are going to start to get warmer, whereas areas like Michigan and the central part of the United States are already starting to suffer Siberian-style winters.
It's true.
But very, very severe winters and then very, very hot summers at the same time, which, of course, is that's hitting us right in the breadbasket, so to speak, because that's where all the food is grown.
All right. I got a fax that I'm not going to reference what has been said by other guests on this program. I'm just going to read it. The email, actually, says, "Babies are dying. Art. Today's Press Enterprise had the following article. This morning, a mysterious disease has killed two babies, left three more seriously ill at an orphanage in Brazil, according to doctors. A three-month-old died Saturday, an 11-month-old Sunday, according to the head of pediatrics at Lagoa, that's L-A-G-O-A Hospital. The disease, which broke out 2 weeks ago at an orphanage, attacks babies' intestines and is caused, quote, by an unknown bacteria." I'll go ahead and say it. I said I wouldn't, but I will. Ed Dames, remote viewer Ed Dames, predicted babies would begin to die. The person who sent me this email says, "Art, I don't like it when Dame's predictions appear to come true. Do you see anything like this? A lot of disease?" Sean?
The major plagues that are going to, when we're talking diseases that are going to kill millions, the major plagues that are going to hit the planet aren't going to occur until about 2002. And it's going to be a strain of influenza, some sort of Spanish or Hong Kong flu that is going to be responsible for killing tens of millions of people. And this is going to be directly after a major war that the United States is going to be involved in beginning sometime in 1998. See, we're in sort of a strange two-year cycle right now, because we're in the 1997-1998 predictions specifically. It all sort of loops together. 1997 is very much a year of manifestation.
And 1998 is not going to be a good year, is it?
Not from anything I can see. Let me put it to you this way. My theory is that a lot of people popularly believe that the United States was actually birthed or born on July 4th of 1776. That was literally sort of when it was conceived. But the actual government was laid into place September 27th of 1791, which is when the Bill of Rights was actually signed. Now, stay with me on this for just a second. It's my belief that unless a nation does certain things that have to do with, I guess, the cosmic laws, it goes all the way back to the first five books of the Old Testament, which is called the Jubilee system, that in the Jubilees you do things every 7 years. And in those 7 years, at the end of 7 years, you break all contracts. You repudiate all debt, which means you couldn't borrow money. It would take you more than 7 years to repay. You let the land lie fallow because it returned the minerals and the nutrients to the topsoil and broke the pest cycle. And then 7 times 7 is 49, and that leads you up to what's called a grand jubilee, in which you let the land lie fallow for 2 years, 49 and 50th year. And the biggest thing is then you break the contracts. You can't work for a man for more than 7 years. Let everybody that committed a petty crime back into the country. And then in the 50th year, the most important thing was to give all the land back to the people that originally owned it. The reason for these laws and codes was because this then kept the money and the property from accumulating in the hands of 1% of the people. Look at the United States now, Art. Who owns everything? 1% of the people. And I think that according to this biblical code, unless a nation follows these particular codes and laws, you have four chances. In other words, four chances of 50 years, and after a 200-year period, you go into what's called the tribulation period. And I think that starting in 1991, that the United States entered a seven-year period in which from 1991 until late 1998, you're looking at a tribulation period which will pretty much break the back of the form of government that we have now, and something else is going to come in to take its place. Now, I'm hoping it's us that decides what's going to come in to take its place, with the economic fracturing of the United States, and I think that that is in tune with what's going on with the rest of the world.
That is the most probable. Since we are the most powerful by any measure, I think that that is the most probable, that we will guide whatever is coming, and we will be the molders of it. I pray that to be so. You agree?
Yes, absolutely.
You agree it's most likely going to be us?
I certainly hope. I mean, you know, in any...
That's a hedge.
Well, it's, you know, the big problem is this is where we get into this gigantic area of choice. I do think that the breaking up of the United States into these independent countries, specifically with Texas leading the way, becoming one of the first states that actually secedes from the Union and becomes an independent country, being known as the Lone Star Republic, I do believe that that's what's going to occur, that people are going to start taking back their power. I see, for example, California and Nevada and certain parts of Oregon all sort of coming together as one large state. I see the central part of the United States, the middle area, which encompasses the states around Nebraska, being called New Jerusalem. I see an area around Utah. It's got a very odd name. It's either called Caleb or Kolob, and it has something to do with the Mormon religion.
Huh.
The central part of Arizona and New Mexico is once again called Hopi Land. A lot of these areas actually go back and they revert to the original American Indian names that they had. Now, as far as the rest of this year goes, as I said, the biggest thing... Oh, here's one thing we should talk about that we didn't have a chance to.
All right.
There's a project that about 2 years ago I was saying that this year was going to be a year in which you'd actually see some kind of extraterrestrial being actually on the TV, on
yes.
television, where
yes,
people
yes.
could see it.
Yes.
And one of the most shocking and startling and amazing revelations that I've seen so far is a documentary that a friend of mine named Jeff Broadstreet is working on, and I saw a piece of footage. It was about 6 minutes long. Supposedly, this footage was smuggled out of Area 51. It has a Department of Naval Intelligence time code on the bottom of it. And what I saw in this footage was the security guard actually took a tape off a wall, pulled the tape out, wrapped it around his hand, broke the tape off, stuck the tape in his pocket, and then put the actual cassette back on the wall so that he could get it out. On this footage, you see a camera is actually looking into an interrogation room through a one-way mirror. You see a general in silhouette. He's got stars and epaulets on his shoulder, and he's talking to another man in a rumpled suit. And the strange thing about it is that he's asking questions of this man, and he's sort of rubbing his head. And at the end of this long table, in a very dark room, you see this thing, this creature with a very, very large, bulbous head, with pinkish blue colored skin, very, very large eyes, a jutting jaw that looks like it looks like the end of a gourd, like the handle on a gourd, with what appears to be sort of a grayish tunic, very thin neck with this very large head, and the thing seems to be bobbing. It literally can't seem to hold its head up. It's sort of it's almost like doing these very unusual spastic motions. The general is actually asking the man next to him the questions. And then the man in the rumpled suit is rubbing his forehead and then giving the general answers as if he's communicating with whatever this creature is telepathically.
Roswell?
I'm sorry?
Roswell?
No, this was taken out of Area 51 about 8 months ago.
8 months ago.
So it's full-color video. What happens at the end of the video is that the creature begins to gasp. Its hands come up as its mouth begins to open and close, and it goes into some sort of fit or seizure where you see some reddish foam actually coming from the side of the creature's mouth.
Good heavens.
Two doctors step in. Next to the creature, you have what appears to be a heart monitor with a very unusual blip, kind of a boom, 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 boom on the heart monitor.
Yes.
Two doctors then step into the video, and one doctor actually takes a piece of gauze and begins to wipe the creature's mouth of the foam, and the other doctor begins to shine a light in its eyes and put its finger in its mouth.
When did you see this,
please? 3 months ago.
3 months ago. Who's got it now?
Jeff Broadstreet is the man who's actually doing the documentary on this.
When do we get to see it?
It'll be out, I think, next month. So
next
you get the preview on the show now. The only other person that's actually been allowed to see it was Chris Criswell, who is a special effects artist, and he was brought in to judge it, and Bob Dean.
And what did they say?
Criswell said it was fairly convincing, that it was a very, that he didn't think it was a puppet, that he didn't think it was a, that he didn't think it was a mannequin. It had too many unusual facial muscles. Bob Dean actually cried when he saw it, because he said that whatever this creature was, that it was absolutely terrified.
All right, Sean, hold yeah. tight. Holy smokes. Once again, to avoid the barrage of faxes, the way to get a copy of this program, when you can get through, is to call 1-800-917-4278. That's 1-800-917-4278.
Stay tuned for more of Art Bell's interview with Sean David Morton on Egypt on this encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell. Taking a well-deserved night off. He'll return to the airwaves live for Dreamland this Sunday and Coast to Coast AM Monday night, Tuesday morning. Tonight, Chancellor Broadcasting presents from March 13th, Art's five-hour interview with Prophet Sean David Morton. And now, the best of Art Bell.
The VTech 900 NDL telephone is 4627. That's 1-800-557-4627. You've got nothing to lose but the fat. Give me a minute at night. You're making 9-6-0-6-0. One other thing that we presently have on the website that I want Sean to comment on. It's going to lead us into an obvious area after some of the predictions and prophecy that has been laid down here. In Kansas, at a lady's house, there is a statue, a plaster statue, of the Virgin Mary. It is crying blood tears. Now, I know this is coming at it from an entirely different direction, but the warning may be very much the same. This is going on all over the world. A religious apparitions, the Virgin Mary crying. Sean, does it all wind up together?
Well, it's not just the statue of the Virgin Mary in Kansas. It's also the appearances to thousands of people of the Virgin Mary in Connors, Georgia.
I know.
The Virgin Mary on the 13th of every month in California City, right out here in the Mojave Desert.
Medjugorje.
Medjugorje. I mean, I was in Medjugorje in 1990, and I excuse me, I was working on the sort of a worldwide documentary, and we interviewed those kids that were actually still going into rapturous trances. And I never forget, we had one of the girls who at that time I think was about 17 years old, weighed about 120 pounds, and I had myself and my cameraman, you know, weighing in at probably a couple hundred pounds apiece while she was in a rapture, literally leaning on her arms. I mean, putting all the weight of our body on her arms while they were uplifted while she was in this rapturous state. Supporting all of our weight, literally becoming invulnerable and super strong while they were in this rapturous state. And they said specifically that the war was going to begin in the next year, that Yugoslavia was going to break up into Bosnia, Serbia, Herzegovina,
right.
that all of the horrors of World War One and World War Two were going to be revisited there on that particular country with the concentration camps and the mass genocide. And that once the United States got involved, that it was going to be about another year and a half before the last great world conflict that involved Islam and the Islamic Jihad and Europe and the United States was actually going to begin in Serbia, in the Bosnia, Serbia, Herzegovina. And everything that they said was absolutely true. Another interesting phenomenon of this is a close friend of mine, a man named Giorgio Bongiovanni. Giorgio is a stigmatist who 7 years ago went to Fatima, and actually I'll send you a picture of Giorgio. You can actually put that one up on the web.
Glad to.
Giorgio went to Fatima, Portugal, and there he had a vision of the Virgin Mary. He was literally hit by a beam of light, and he began to bleed from the sign of the cross, from out of his hands, from out of his feet, and actually each year on his birthday, which is September 5th, he gets a new apparition, literally a new appropriation coming from his body. First it was the sign of the cross on his forehead in blood, then it was coming out of his hands, then the shape of a chalice in his chest, then the wound. This last year he began to actually cry tears of blood, exactly like the statue in Kansas, and pinpricks of blood. And the most interesting thing about the blood that comes out of him is that it coagulates in less than 30 seconds, and it smells like roses. It literally smells like concentrated rose oil.
All right, look, I want to stop you for a second, Sean, and I want to tell you this. No offense, but any single person, even yourself, you're literate, you're laying it out for us in a way that not many have on this program. But let me tell you, whether it's you, Sean, or Ed Dames, or Malachi Martin, or Robert Morningsky, or Lori Toy, or a whole group of others coming from every kind of spiritual discipline one can imagine, you all seem to be headed down slightly different roads to precisely the same a destination at about the same time. End of statement. I mean, I you know, so you come at it from your direction, but as I listen to you, the hair on the back of my neck begins to stand up from the others that I've listened to.
Yes. Well,
I mean, you go to these conferences, Sean.
I was going to say that ultimately, that there are three paths. As I said, that there are the people who are going to hold together and hang together, that are going to make, that at the same time, all of this horror is going to be happening on the planet, that some of the most brilliant, amazing advances are going to be made in civilization as people start to come together. I mean, we are literally now in the birth pangs of laying what I think, here in the United States and Canada specifically, is going to be heaven on earth. That it is my, and this is just my personal belief.
Birth pangs. You know, that's one definition of quickening.
The quickening, exactly.
Yeah.
And it's my personal belief that the United States and Canada are unique in the fact that this is just my personal religion now, that we're the chosen land, that we are the second holy land that was prepared in the wilderness, that in the book of Joel, I think it says, that the second holy land would be a place between, that would be bordered to the south by a great river, have two shining seas on the east and west coast, and its northern border would be the top of the world. And I think that this area now, that what we are doing and what we are creating amongst ourselves, amongst community, it is going to be the basis for the greatest leap in peace, joy, and consciousness that the world has ever seen. And I do believe that there's a messianic figure that is actually going to incarnate sometime in around 2034. Now, my beliefs are a little different because I think it's going to be a female messianic figure that will become known as the Emanuela. But this is what I'm seeing for the future after this 40-year period that actually all begins in 1999. So I don't see that as an ending point at all. I see it as the fracturing of the old structures and the old ways in order for new things to appear and arise.
How many make it to the other side, though?
In my call them travels, because what I've done is actually gone to about 100 years from now and projected myself there and tried to look around, and there's about 2 billion people on the planet at that time, about 100 years from now. It's very interesting because the coastline of California, we've lost about maybe 60 miles in some places, but it's still intact. The Mississippi River is very wide, you know, but I'm talking a long ways down the pike here. The whole world is actually ruled from Omaha, Nebraska, strangely enough.
I mean, Omaha.
That's like the capital of the planet at that time. It's because the planet moves away from a currency-based monetary system and goes back to a commodity-based monetary system. So the entire farming community becomes much more powerful. But the two specific places are, 100 years from now, the Emanuela is about 60 years old, I think. She's born in 2034. And she's born somewhere in Ireland and Stonehenge and has something to do with being a direct descendant of Jesus of Nazareth. She's somehow related to the house of David or Benjamin somehow. And she rules back and forth between the lower portion of England, specifically Stonehenge, and the center part of the United States, which is actually at that time the center of a block in the center of the country that's called New Jerusalem.
All right. This year coming, this spring, beginning, the new crop season across America, across England, crop circles. It was a hell of a year last year. What do you see for this year? And what are crop circles?
Well, you know, I don't know what the crop circles are. I mean, I can tell you, for example, what Carlos Diaz has said, what Adrienne has said, specifically that they are extraterrestrial glyphs, that they're being made specifically in the Stonehenge area because the Stonehenge area is the solar plexus chakra of the planet.
Okay.
There are six main chakras on the planet: Lhasa Tibet, which is the root chakra, Cairo, Egypt, which is the prostate ovarian chakra, the second chakra, Stonehenge, which is the third chakra, the solar plexus chakra through which, like a cord of light, connects all human beings together. Fourth chakra is like two ventricles of the heart because it's a double chakra. It's Easter Island and Machu Picchu. Fifth chakra of the planet is the throat chakra of the world, which is actually that which is said here is actually heard and seen all across the world, and that's, believe it or not, downtown Los Angeles. And the sixth chakra is Osaka, Japan, which is that why there has been such a relation between the Northridge quake in Los Angeles, and then almost 1 year and almost to the minute, a year later, you then have the Osaka earthquake as well, as all of these different areas of the planet begin to adjust. The crop circle specifically, and I'll give you Adrien's interpretation as an example, he says that they're a warning by the Pleiadians to the dark forces on this planet that unless they allow mankind to evolve with the ever-expanding and opening RNA-DNA helix, literally acting as an antenna to receive a whole new set of signals or cosmic information, that these evil beings will be forcibly removed by these extraterrestrials, supposedly by 2004. Now, one of the things that I predicted in the newsletter before that was that the new series of crop circles that were going to happen last May, and this was months in advance, were going to be much bigger and much more spectacular than they ever were.
Well, they were. Much bigger.
And, of course, the first crop circle was a 12-strand RNA-DNA helix.
Yep.
Now, interestingly enough, human beings supposedly only have 46 base pairs per turn. So are we evolving into that? Is that, in essence, are we going from a 7-chakra energy system to a 12-chakra energy system? And is that the helix of what mankind and humanity is going to evolve into? These circles, again, just in the last year, got bigger and bigger and bigger. The first one was 730 feet. The next one was 950. The next one after that, it was almost 1,500 over a series of fields.
So the question is, what about this year?
This year, I think you're going to see, my prediction is, once again, starting sometime around the first full moon in May, you are going to see crop circles over 3 or 4 fields. It will be an average of crop circles of about 1,200 feet. Those will be average. You're going to see more and more video of the actual circles being formed and made as whatever's making them becomes more bolder, if you will. And I think that you're going to see direct correlations to the crop circles and how they are going to relate not only to the series of comets, specifically the Hale-Bopp comet that's coming by, which is obviously a big deal. It's a turning point in human history. It's the Blue Star Comet. It has a lot to do with what is what's going on in the planet. So I think the only prediction that I have for the crop circles is going to be that the crop circles are going to somehow relate directly to the DNA and biology, and we are going to learn things about the atomic structure of matter and our own DNA and our own biology by actually studying the circles.
All right. I want to do some quick things, Sean. I promised I've got to do it. First time caller line, you're on the air with Sean Morton. Hi.
Hi.
Where are you?
I'm in West North Carolina.
All right.
And I'd like to say hello to you, Art, and to Sean. I've only listened to your show very recently.
Yes, sir. Do you have a question?
Yes, I do. One, I saw some things a while ago about some pyramids in Peru.
Oh, yes.
And I wanted to know about what Sean had to say about that.
All right. True, Sean. They are there, aren't they?
It was very difficult for me to hear him.
Peru. Pyramids in Peru.
The pyramid, I don't know that much about them. I mean, the structures in Peru that I know of are way up in the highlands. I mean, they're They're sort of in the tropical rainforest up there. I know that there's a series of pyramids in the Yucatan that are also way far up in the highlands.
A lot of news lately about Cusco in Peru, as a matter of fact. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Sean Morton. Hi.
Hey, Art. Good morning, Art. Good morning, Sean.
Hi.
Hey, Art. This is John from Martinez, California.
Yes, sir.
I'm also ID4 Eagle 1, the guy with the rocket experiments who's been trying to get in touch with you.
Yes. As you know, we've got an expert on rockets that are going to be launching suborbital rockets this coming weekend. Anyway, go ahead, sir.
Right. I'd like to know the two-part question. In your Egyptology studies, have you seen any proof that verifies what there's a particular African tribe that states that it's really descendants from Cyrus B, an unseen companion that orbits Cyrus B?
Yeah, the Dogon tribe.
Right.
Yeah, we did I did a story on them a long time ago. The relations are is that the Dogons for thousands of years have known that Sirius was a binary star. They have all of their festivals are related to a cycle of, I think it's 31 and a half years, which is the exact rotation of Sirius A around Sirius B. They talk about the black races actually coming from Sirius B and the red races coming from Sirius A. I mean, they knew a great deal about Sirius until we actually even discovered that Sirius was a binary star with the Palomar scopes in the 1940s.
Okay. Also, in your future world, does cloning play a part?
Good question.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was one of the big things that, one of the major hits in the newsletter just this last month. Let me put it to you this way. I've known from seeing videotape that was taken out of a government facility, and this was for a show we had on the Sci-Fi Channel called Declassified for a while, a startling piece of video footage that actually showed a security camera inside some kind of facility that showed large sacks, about a dozen of these sacks, and then it led off into another corridor in which you could see more of these sacks. But they were hanging from what looked like black funnels from the ceiling, and inside these sacks were some kind of beings or creatures that were actually being grown. And this videotape was from 1978. So, I mean, I think that the cloning phenomenon has been something that, let me put it above cloning. If we figured out a way to crack the human genome, and I believe that we probably either mapped it and cracked it, at least the government has it, the secret aspects of the government, sometime in the mid to late 1970s, according to what this tape I saw. On the rest of this tape, it showed an experiment in which a scientist who called himself Dr. Klaus, this crazy German guy, actually was showing in the experiment that they were crossbreeding a laboratory mammal, in this case a hamster, with a plant. I mean, I'm not kidding. I mean, this is
what?
He's actually taking aloe vera cytoplasm and mixing it with the protoplasm of a laboratory animal and mixing the two of them together with what they called genetic plugs. And
oh,
what these were
God.
Is that they were studs that went in the helix of the DNA that were neutral. They weren't positive or negative, which allowed the signal of the DNA to actually make the jump over them. And he grew this thing. I mean, over a period of time, there was this as wild as this sounds, there was some kind of sort of bizarre plant that had some hamster care. I mean, literally had little feet at the bottom of the plant. And at the end of this, he was showing that they were actually looking for money in the video. He wanted $55,000 because he said now that they can crossbreed certain types of mammal cells with certain types of plant cells. And that the next step of that became the introduction of rat genes or rat DNA into tomatoes and tobacco plants as part of a genetic patent, which now allows both of these plants, specifically tomatoes, to grow much larger and not freeze and also have a much longer shelf life. The same thing with tobacco.
And I'll tell you, the new world may be too bold for me. Listen to me, my friend. Hold on. We'll get back to you, and we will try and concentrate more on the phones when we get back in the final hour. Also, we are going to ask Sean, because he is somebody who knows about this, and we're going to ask Sean about the Chupacabra, because I know he knows something about it.
Stay tuned for more of The Best of Art Bell right after a word from your local sponsors.
Do you... STP.
Bell is taking a well-deserved night off. He'll return to the airwaves live for Dreamland this Sunday and Coast to Coast AM Monday night, Tuesday morning. Tonight, Chancellor Broadcasting presents from March 13th Art's riveting five-hour interview with Prophet Sean David Morton and his latest insights on Egypt. And now, the best of Art Bell.
All right, look, let's for a second talk about my favorite subject. It is absolutely radio all the way. I love radio. Love it. And the ATS-909 by Sanjin is the world's best portable radio. Now, let me say that again. The ATS-909 by Sanjin is the world's best portable radio. Period. I say that. The World Radio TV Handbook gives it 5 stars, as many as you can get. It receives AM, FM, shortwave. It gets all of shortwave from down below broadcast in longwave to 30 megahertz in continuous coverage. It's got separate sharp upper and lower sideband filters for shortwave. It has RDS reception on FM. The AM sensitivity and selectivity is superb. And it, if you add an antenna, it does not go into overload. This is an amazing advance in radio. It's got one button you can push when you go into a new town, and it automatically goes through and logs all of the AM and FM stations in your new town automatically into your memories. This is the radio. It's not cheap. Shouldn't be either. With it, you get the 500-page 1997 passport to World Band Radio, and the price delivered to your door is $289.95. $289.95. And boy, is it worth it. I'm telling you. So, and don't forget, along with buying this radio, if you call tomorrow, beginning at 10 a.m. Eastern, 7 Pacific, they'll send you a free catalog. They only do this about once, twice, maybe 3 times a year. Can you get a Seacrane Company catalog? It's like the Bible of radio. You know, it's the best. So, if you want the catalog, it's free. Or you want to buy the Sanjin, it's the best. Call 1-800-522-8863. That's 1-800-522-8863. A very strange thing occurred recently in San Antonio. A farmer saw an animal in a trap. It was struggling. It was trying to get away. Next to it, 2 other similar animals, literally jumping up and down. The story goes, the farmer approached the trap, something I would not have done. And as he approached, the other 2 ran away, or galloped away, or whatever. He thought about, or began to try to free this animal, and it looked like it was going to take his arm off, so he quit and left. Next day, came back, it was dead. One of the larger television stations in that area somehow got over there and got videotape of this creature. Whatever in the hell it is, was. I had a good friend who was at that station. Well, he is now, anyway. And I called him immediately as I got this news report. He sent me a videotape. I took a still photograph from it. That's on my website now. Is it the chupacabra? I don't know. It may be. At any rate, if you want to look-see, it's on my website at www.artbell.com, which brings me again to Sean David Morton, and let's find out what he knows about this Well, I don't know if it's a mythical creature or not. I know there's many, many, many dead animals that have had the blood taken from their bodies. What's out there, Sean?
When I originally investigated the Chupacabra, it was when I was one of the original producers on Strange Universe. We were working on the pilot, and this was December of 95, in the early part of 1996. It appears as though, as far as I can tell, this phenomenon began in Puerto Rico sometime in December of 1994. And by the time I'd gotten there, and of course the number's gone up quite a bit, but by the time I got there in late December 95, early 96, the death toll from these creatures, chupacabra, of course meaning goat sucker, was about 2,000 domestic pets and agricultural animals.
Right.
Now, I was in Puerto Rico for the better part of 3 weeks, and I'm good friends with Jorge Martin, and actually Jorge is the man who is the Lord God Supreme of UFOs down there in Puerto Rico.
Right.
But in our excursions around the island, for example, we went to, I spoke to the Secretary of Agriculture, who said that that these attacks were nothing but monkeys that had escaped from a local park, claiming that they were baboons. Now, there's no baboons in Puerto Rico, by the way. That these conceivably might be wild dogs that are attacking these animals, and that there was nothing to it, that it was just something that these the Puerto Rican peasants had simply made up.
Well, here's the dividing line, though, Sean. As far as I know, there is no animal that sucks the blood from its victim. There are bats that bite and lick.
Right.
But they don't suck the blood from their victim. Well, now, did you find animals with blood removed?
Yes. Now, this is what we then found. We then went to a, it was New Year's Eve, and New Year's Day, we got a call from a man by the name of Confessor Morales, who is a farmer and also the principal of a local high school in Carnavaños,
mm-hmm.
Which is a suburb of San Juan, Puerto Rico. We were at his house. Less than, I would say, the attack actually happened at 5:15 a.m., 16, 17, 8:15, 9:15. We were there by 10:15, so we were there within about 5 hours of an attack on his farm. He says that he was woken up early in the morning, went down to the rabbit hutch. He has a rabbit run with a series of cages, that there were three creatures, that these creatures were approximately about 3.5 feet tall, strong kangaroo-like legs, large-hipped, that they were of different colors. One was sort of a yellow, another one was reddish, another one was sort of a mawkish black. Very, very large reddish eyes with spikes or fins, or actually described them as being sort of black spikes with what appeared to be sort of opaque fins running down the back, with a webbing underneath these short, stumpy arms that ran from the wrist down to the hip. Now, he said that when he shined the light on these things and his dog was barking at them, that one of them actually picked up nearly 90-pound cage, tore it up from its foundations, and threw it up a hill about 15 feet at him. And, of course, he ran back into the house, and all these creatures ran away. Now, when we got on the scene, there was a pile of these dead rabbits. And the rabbits, they had torn away the steel cages, reached in, choked the rabbits to death, and you could tell by the bulging eyes on the animals, and then laid them in a straight line, almost like a sizzler buffet, and they had started to then drill circular precision holes into the skull in which all the blood in these animals had been sucked out. There was no rigor mortis, nothing. And I was on the scene probably in some cases less than 3 hours on four separate occasions. During a wave of these attacks while I was there. Now, we took these to Carlos Soto, who was a veterinarian who was trained at the University of Kansas, and he then showed us the circular drill holes in the rabbits, saying, look, it's very difficult. I mean, not even with a surgical drill could you drill these holes. All the blood has been sucked out of the animal. The animals were choked first, and then he walked us into a morgue in which there were about 60 more of these animals that he had on ice. There were everything from goats, sheep, Doberman pincers, pit bulls, all kinds of animals. I mean, every single one of which had either two fang marks with a circular punch drill hole, because apparently these creatures have a tongue that's about 6 to 8 inches long that drills these perfectly circular holes and then sucks the blood out of the animal. Now, in this case also, And here's why Puerto Rico is kind of unusual. Puerto Rico has the largest rainforest in U.S. territory, virgin rainforest. It also has a massive cave system or structure underneath, in other words, a large number of tunnels underneath Puerto Rico upon which the island is based. It also happens to be the home of Arecibo, which is the largest radio telescope in the world, which was built in 1964. Now, there's been also a wave of UFO phenomenon that has somehow been associated with this.
Right.
Some witnesses actually claiming that they've actually seen these creatures being taken up in beams inside the craft. I actually didn't get to talk to any of those witnesses. These were people that Jorge had spoken to. And, of course, Puerto Rico is somewhat unique in the federal domain because it's not a state like California and Nevada. It's actually it's a commonwealth. It's the federal government can pretty much do anything it wants down there and get away with it. Now, since I first did the first story on the Chupacabra in North America for Strange Universe, it was then front page of the LA Times, front page of the Wall Street Journal, and in May of last year, I turn on Fox News right after X-Files in Los Angeles, and out in San Bernardino, there's a pile of dead rabbits, all with these perfectly circular drill holes in their skull, exactly like I had seen in Puerto Rico. And apparently, they had spread from Puerto Rico up through Florida, Pensacola, Miami, Pensacola, St. Petersburg, then into Texas, specifically Austin, outside of Houston, which is where your friend saw this in the cage. And now it's spread here to California, Santa Clarita, San Bernardino. There was a man about 2 months ago on the news that had his arm chewed by one of these creatures when it was attacking his dog.
What is this thing, Sean?
I don't know. It could be one of three things. One, it could be a genetic experiment of some kind. Literally, because it seems to have insect characteristics, reptilian characteristics, gray ET characteristics. The creatures appear to be chameleonic. They can change color. They're amphibious because they actually use the water systems, what they call the impulsoros, which are like the sewers, and they live in the swamps. And, of course, all the brush there is about 3 feet high, so it's very frightening. It became such a panic while I was there that I literally for 3 nights was tromping through the jungle armed to the teeth with machetes and machine guns, with the Civil Defense Force and the National Guard beating the bushes for these things because it was destroying the livestock in Puerto Rico. The second thing this could be is some kind of cyclical creature. In other words, like a phoenix that maybe lays its eggs like once every 100 years or so and then pops up in a cycle and will suck the blood out of various creatures and then go back dormant again to pop up in another 100 years. Now, remember, too, that Puerto Rico being unique is that there's a cave system there with the rainforest, the Oyunque rainforest, which has been closed by the military, by the way. About 3 weeks ago, they closed the entire Oyunque rainforest down because there have been so many sightings and photographs, not only of ETs and chupacabras, but these very unusual kind of gray aliens with sort of an odd blonde hair. They look like elves, literally look like sprites that we've run some photos of on Strange Universe. The other thing that I can think of is that maybe it's something that's interdimensional, that literally as we approach this great change that the walls between dimensions are actually getting thinner and these things are actually popping through the dimensions. Or my favorite theory is that maybe some UFO stopped for gas and they left the window down and Skippy got out the window and and that's what the abduction's about. They're picking people up, showing them pictures, saying, "Have you seen Skippy?"
So, all right. On that note, let's go back to the phones. I promise everybody, Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Sean David Morton. Hi.
Hi, Art and Sean. First of all, real quick, Art, I've got that Mirror Space thing downloaded. I'm going to try and get it translated by my Russian teacher tomorrow, and if I have success, I'll...
I also heard Mirror after the show. We'll talk to Sean about that in a moment. Go ahead.
Okay. Sean, I read in a book by James Laver written in 1942 called Nostradamus, or The Future Foretold, in which, by the way, he accurately describes the end of World War II, which is what impressed me.
Mm-hmm.
He said that Nostradamus says... that on July 7th, 1999, my prophecy will be fulfilled. And he says this is the only major date that Nostradamus gave. and it seemed to be associated with some sort of, you know, overall major prophecy. Do you have any idea what he was talking about, what this was about?
Yeah, it was the, it's the destruction of New York City.
Yeah, I guess that would be pretty major, though.
Yeah, and he gives, and actually Nostradamus only gives he doesn't specifically say the seventh day, but he says July of 1999. He talks about the new city at the 45th parallel is attacked by from the sky by somebody he calls the King of Terror, and it has a lot to do. My interpretation of it is that it's a some kind of nuclear attack via a submarine. Something sneaks up on the coast and lobs a bomb onto New York. Actually, New York City is successfully defended during the first attack, but the electromagnetic pulse actually wipes out all the banking records and all the computer records, and causes a pretty substantial mass evacuation of New York. But as I was saying in my predictions, that I think that we're going to have a full-scale war sometime by late 1998, and that July of 1997 is going to be some kind of sneak attack, I think, by the Islamic Jihad.
Boy, 98 is really shaping up as a lousy year.
Well, it's going to be, it's once again, it's the year, it's a numerologically, it's a 9 year. It's the year of initiation.
Yeah, let me tell you something that I know is going on right now. I can only talk about parts of what I know, and I'm really sorry about that, but I have promised some people. Sean, there's trouble on Mir. 4 of 5 oxygen systems are down. The wrong kind of gases are building up. A couple of cosmonauts reportedly nearly lost their lives. They're in a life-threatening situation. The Russians cannot get back up to get them. The word is that NASA has been appealed to by the Russians to get a shuttle up. There is a brewing disaster on Mir that's not being reported. Any thoughts?
Well, I've heard about the oxygen problems that they've had on the news. I mean, you know, the problem is that Mir, our biggest problem with docking with the Mir is that it's so antiquated. I mean, it's just, I remember talking to the astronauts that docked with the Soyuz.
Yes.
Who said that the Russian technology is a piece of junk. I mean, it's just garbage. And our biggest problem with going up there is we're literally putting our people and our astronauts at risk.
I realize I've heard the exact same thing.
It's junk.
Yeah,
it's
junk.
It's 30 years behind anything the United States has. You know, all I can say is that I was under the impression that we have another shuttle mission that was supposed to be going up in another couple of weeks. But I don't really have...
I was just wondering whether you had any sense that there's a lot going on or that it is so much more serious than we are being told.
I think if there's any type of oxygen problems on a space station are bad. I mean, they're facing the exact same kind of scenario that the Apollo 13 guys faced. And they're having to cobble together literally cardboard boxes and filters to filter out the carbon dioxide, very much like the Apollo 13 astronauts did.
Exactly right. All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Sean David Morton. Hello, where are you, please?
This is Jim, and I'm from Chicago.
Hi, Jim. How's it going in Chicago?
Oh, it's pretty good.
Good.
Just getting a little colder again. This is a question, and please don't hang up on me because I can't hear you on the radio anymore now.
All right.
This is out of left field a little bit, but there's this thing that I have a problem with when it comes to issues of paranormal prophecy, et cetera.
Okay.
And, Sean, obviously you're very familiar with the Old Testament and all that. This issue of, quote-unquote, forbidden knowledge and things that we're... that we could find out about, but we're supposedly not supposed to. And
yes.
I just wondered if you had struggled with this at all and what your take was on all that.
One of the reasons why in the Old Testament they were called prophets is because the word prophet actually meant teacher or singer of righteousness. The reason for that was because the prophets used to have a backup band in the Middle East. You'd literally have sort of singers and dancers and people hitting timpani instruments as the laws and the words were actually being spoken. The reason prophets predicted the future the way that they did was because they were trying to teach the laws of creation, very much like I was talking about with that everything was in multiplicatives of seven. You were supposed to do certain things. And a prophet actually was predicting the future by telling people that if you do A, B, and C, then X, Y, Z is going to follow. Does that make sense? Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
He's here.
Okay. I might have cut him off there.
No,
I'm here. I'm just listening.
Okay, the point behind prophecy was to show them that if you disobeyed the laws of creation, if you disobeyed certain moral laws and codes, that there were inevitable results, that they were, in essence, talking about the laws of karma, and that they could predict what was going to occur in the future by showing people what had happened in the past. And, of course, the best example of this was Jonah, who went into the city of Nineveh, which was doomed by Yahweh, and specifically Jonah then preached to the people, and the people changed their ways and repented and prayed and meditated, and the city was not destroyed. And, of course, Jonah was made like the king of the town because people listened to what it is he had to say. Now, the forbidden knowledge that I think you're talking about is like I used to do personal psychic readings for people, and I don't do them anymore, specifically because I do think that that's the kind of knowledge, you know, it all gets obsessed with people that all they want to know about is sex and money. I used to work on a psychic hotline for a while, and that's all anybody ever called about was sex and money, and I got so sick of talking about it because I was having visions that had more to do with the planet and more to do with all of mankind in general, that I got tired of dealing with the petty trivia of what was going on. So, I mean, I do wrestle it as far as the forbidden knowledge goes, but at the same time, I also think that biblically, every single one of the prophets gave warnings of various things that were going to happen, one so that the faithful could prepare, and another one so maybe those that were sort of on the edge might listen and change their ways and possibly avert the catastrophe.
Well, you seem to be confirming something which seems to be the case, and that this idea of forbidden knowledge is not so much something that, you know, came down from God or whatever, but instead was created by the people who had the ability to attain this knowledge,
yes,
to sort of keep the quote-unquote layman from abusing it, as you're describing.
Well, I don't think that there is any question that is so big that God can't answer it.
There you go. All right, John, hold tight. When we come back, we are going to give out, so everybody go get your pencil and pen ready. We're going to give out the number to get Sean's newsletter. In the area of about an 85% hit rate. And also when we come back, we will ask Sean, 85%, well, that's good. But the biblical scholars out there will say 85% good, but not a true prophet. A true prophet is 100%. And I'd like to hear Sean address that. So we'll tell you how to get his newsletter, and we'll ask him about that when we come back. In the meantime, again, to protect my own butt, because my fax machine is burning up right now. Yes, I know it's a hot show. If you want to get a copy of it, the way to do it is call 1-800-917-4278. Please, oh, please write that number down. That's 1-800-659-2669. Back now to Sean David Morton. Sean, I promised everybody, and therefore I must deliver your newsletter. By now, a lot of people are going to want it. Tell them in detail, please, how to get your newsletter.
Okay, once again, it's real easy. It's the Delphi Associates newsletter. For $50, you get 12 issues a year. They're all 12 pages apiece, the newsletter, so it's a it's a good deal. You can call for the information if you like, 310-217-7579. That's 310-217-7579, and all the information will be on the voicemail. If you like, please send $50 to PRI, that's the Prophecy Research Institute, and we're located at 2207 Hermosa Avenue, H-E-R-M-O-S-A, and that is in Hermosa Beach, California, and the zip code is 90254. So that's Prophecy Research Institute, 2207 Hermosa Avenue, Hermosa Beach, California, 90254, or you can call the hotline, which is 310-217-7579.
All right, I want to ask you a hard question. How long has your newsletter been published?
Since February, March of 1993.
Of 93?
Yes.
All right. That's good. Because a lot of newsletters, Sean, start up and people subscribe, and 6 months later, they're out of business.
Well, not this one.
It's fairly important to know that you've been around for a while, and
well,
I guess you have.
We've had a hiatus of a couple of months because I was in Egypt and I was working on a lot of film projects, but we're back online. And as a matter of fact, the next issue of the newsletter is going to be all about the alien interview. This bizarre piece of footage has come out of Area 51. And if people are interested in ordering the back issues of the newsletter, specifically the 22-page interview with Audrey Ayn, that's going to be, we have booklets of the newsletters that all have 12 newsletters apiece in each one. And those are $20 apiece. But all the information will be on the, 310-217-7579 number.
All right. I can't let you get away without saying something about Flight 800. You know what's going on right now. I'm sure you're up on the news. Can you tell us anything at all?
The biggest problem leading up to that has been the fact that it used to be that the B-2 bombers used to target things out in the middle of the Nevada desert, and they're not doing that anymore. They're actually targeting U.S. cities. They're doing war games over major cities where they're calculating dropping bombs at 40,000 feet. And it's my personal belief after seeing all the evidence that's been presented that why would the Pentagon want to stonewall this thing unless it was, in fact, a U.S. naval reconnaissance, it was a war game of some kind that I think got out of hand. I knew somebody that was actually on that the beach out there in New York who actually saw the flash of light going up towards the plane, and there were a number of helicopters in the area that were actually playing war games with submarines, where the submarines would actually shoot surface-to-air missiles up to hit a target that was being dragged behind a series of choppers. And I personally believe that there was also another piece of evidence that was taken from a U.S. spy satellite that captured photographic evidence of a missile following a path from the ocean directly into the 747 airliner, and that's all been stonewalled by the military. So I think it was surface-to-air guided missile. There's also been numerous reports of blue lightning, a Star Wars-type laser weapon system that's been operating right off the New Jersey coast. So it's been reported that the FBI probe of the airliner crash is being totally stonewalled by the Pentagon, which is withholding all this vital evidence concerning the crash. So I personally think it was a military maneuver that just got out of hand, exactly like they blew up the 747 in the Persian Gulf War that was coming at the remember the Iranian airliner that they blew out of the sky?
I think it was an Airbus.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's the same thing.
Yes, I recall. All right. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Sean David Morton. Hi.
Good morning, Art.
Good morning. Where are you?
I'm calling from L.A. My name's George.
Yes, George.
Hey, George, you're right next door.
Good morning, Mr. Morton.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
I used to live in Hermosa Beach. I loved it.
Yeah, it's a nice place, isn't it?
Yeah. My question, I recently read a Catholic periodical of a friend of mine in which the writer of the thing, I think he was a priest, he may not have been, he was talking about Satan. And he said Satan puts great stock in symbolism, thus the 666 thing.
Yes.
And he said, notice the twice 666 is 1332 when the Catholic Church split apart.
Mm-hmm.
Three times 666 is 1998.
Mm.
He said, maybe we can expect some
this is all leading up to 1998, isn't it, Art?
Yeah, it sure seems to be. I kept that hit me between the eyes when you said that tonight.
Well, yeah, and also when you figure, too, that the theory is that Jesus was actually born between 7 B.C. and 2 B.C., the Great Pyramid of Giza actually puts the birth of the central messianic figure at September 27th of 2 BC.
All right, here.
So that's why 1998, technically, late 1998 is the beginning of the next millennium.
Here's a fact you'll be interested in. Aren't your guest predictions about the breakup of the U.S. in pieces are indeed uncanny? 3 years ago, I took a road trip across the U.S. and especially the western states. There was a new form of border crossing called port of entry implemented at state lines.
Uh-huh.
There were often signs advertising various militia groups adopting sections of interstate highway for cleanup and advertising private military academies as a substitute for the public schools. A radio program in St. Louis openly advocated a right-wing revolution. I expect the border guards to ask for my papers any day now. Is that where it's going?
Well, one of the things that Richard Nixon said, I think prophetically, was that the United States, if you take away an outside threat like Russia or China, that the United States would simply implode in and on itself, and that it would begin to break up into the individual states. I don't really have too much of a problem with it because, I think that already you're seeing the focus being away from the federal government and the states themselves and communities re-empowering themselves and tearing power away from the federal government. Remember, too, that this summer, and this is one thing that we haven't mentioned really, but one of the major things that's going to go on this summer is that 1967 may have been the summer of love, but 1997 is hardly going to be anything like that, because there's going to be riots in most of the major cities across the United States because nearly 1.5 million people are just all at once going to be shunted off the welfare rolls. And if you think the economy is going to absorb all these people and find jobs for these guys, I mean, you know, these people have another thing coming.
What happened to the age of Aquarius?
It's coming, but all I can tell you is that there are three paths to this, and there is a polarization that is occurring where there is the gang of people who are headed towards darkness and despair because that's what they've created. Another gang of people that really don't care one way or another, sort of the sheep that kind of sit on the middle of the fence.
It's a big bunch, yeah.
A big bunch in the middle. The one that Jesus said, "Be hot or be cold, or I shall spit you from my mouth." And then there's the rest of the gang, and I think that gang has a lot to do with everybody who's within the sound of my voice tonight, who is actually growing and learning and evolving and moving upwards towards the light. And the biggest thing about the future is that everybody's stuff is pretty much going to be taken away. It's already happening in the Midwest and in the South, and it's all going to be about what you know and who you know. It's going to be about knowledge and family. Those are going to be the two biggest things, and the more you know and the closer you are with your family, and I'm not just talking about...
See, for a minute there, it sounded like you were saying the whole country is going to be like Hollywood.
Well...
What you know, who you know.
But it is. It's all, you know, the Hollywood's all about relationships and perceptions, and so here it's going to be all about, this new paradigm that's coming into view is going to be about literally very much the U.S. going back to almost like a tribal system where it's a, you know, large groups of people then are interacting very much like the American Indians did.
All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Sean David Morton. Hi.
Yeah, hi, Arch.
Where are you, sir?
I'm calling from Valparaiso, Indiana. This is Paul from Green Bay.
Yes, Paul.
Hey, Paul.
Yeah, hi. Super show, by the way. In the early hours of March 1st in Southern California, near Palm Springs, I had a very deeply religious experience. And it's the second time I've had such an experience. I wanted to ask your guest, since you mentioned that certain individuals prevent earthquakes,
yes,
prayer and that type of thing.
Yes.
I wanted to ask him if it's possible that it could go the other way, that certain individuals through religious experience could actually cause some type of manifestation, i.e. weather.
I would imagine I could answer that. If individuals are able to cause a tragedy, then no doubt they can prevent it or go the other way. Isn't that true?
Indeed, yeah. I completely agree.
Okay, good. Easily answered. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Sean David Morton. Hi.
Hi, this is Eric in Seattle.
Hi, Eric.
Hey, Eric, I'm going to be in Seattle.
Oh, great.
I'm going to be up there.
Looking forward to you.
I'm going to be up there next weekend at the Whole Life Expo, 21st, 22nd, 23rd.
Where at?
At the convention center right by the Space Needle.
So I have two questions for you.
I expect you to be there.
Oh, I'll try to make it. Thanks. If I don't have to work. Okay, I have two questions for you. As you know, Seattle sits pretty close to what's been called the most dangerous volcano in the world,
yep.
Mount Rainier, yes. And there's lots of seismologists and geologists that they predict that it's about due to erupt at any time. What do you see about that?
I don't think it's right away. Once again, I don't see it happening for another year. They've been pretty good about my vision of Mount Rainier was of a how can I say, sort of a very grumpy Indian man, like an American Indian who was cloaked in a white cloak with his legs being very uncomfortable, and it was almost as if he was readjusting his legs in order to get more comfortable. I see the mountain actually shifting. I think that actually Mount Baker is more volatile than Rainier is. Remember that if the Rainier was to actually blow, there would be so much soot and ash and gas coming out of Rainier that it would have the potential of actually lowering the temperature of the North American continent by almost 3 degrees. Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines, when it blew in 91, lowered the temperature of North America by almost 1 degree, which is had a lot to do with causing a lot of the freak weather of the early 1990s. This is once again one of those things where, because I work with maps and because I do meditations with maps, that the closer I get to an event, the easier it is for me to see and feel.
Of all the prophecy and visions that you have had, Sean, what would you say is the scariest and most foreboding?
The New Madrid fault and the destruction of New York City, the major, like an atomic blast over New York City. Some sort of chemical weapon sometime around 2002 that was takes out Washington, D.C., or actually what's left of Washington, D.C. by that time. A lot of it had to do with the plague as well. I mean, that was just something that couldn't be escaped. It was just everywhere.
That'll do, Sean.
I mean, it gets pretty dark.
Yeah, that'll do. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Sean David Morton. Hi.
Hi, Will, KSTP, St. Paul, Minnesota.
Got
hey,
a question,
Will? How's it going, eh?
Fooling being done of We the People by some of your guests are Tish Tish.
Well, I don't know what that's supposed to mean, Will. Tish Tish for not making any sense. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Sean David Morton. Hello.
King Arthur.
Yes.
Mitch, the Magic Christian.
How you doing?
Calling you from beautiful Ventura by the Sea, California.
Yes, sir.
Hey, how's it going up there? We're neighbors.
Hey, Sean. Hey, listen, man. I got a little problem with Omaha being the ruling center of the world as far as a capital.
Well,
why?
I don't think it's the fun capital of the world either. I mean, but you know, it's just what I see as being a major capital.
I think Omaha couldn't do any worse than D.C. is now.
Well, I think the people in Omaha are nice, but it has to do with something changing as far as the monetary system goes, whereas the central monetary structure is now based on New York and the interest banking structure, that when that goes, Omaha becomes the center of a commodity-based system.
Caller, what's your problem with Omaha?
Well, what about all those prophecies in my King James Bible that say that his Christ is going to rule and reign for 1,000 years from Jerusalem?
Well, what if I told you that the United States is the new Jerusalem? And what if I also told you that Omaha was the center of 4 or 5 states that are actually called New Jerusalem?
Well, then I'd have to think about that.
Well, think about it.
Because that's what I see. I see two holy lands. I see the old holy land, but there was a second holy land that was actually promised in the wilderness, and the second holy land would be bordered to the south by a great river, to the east and west by shining seas, and its northern border would be the top of the world.
Well, does this have to do also with the fulfillment of the 1,500-mile square new city of Jerusalem?
That actually, if you actually read Revelations, the actual descending of the four-squared city of Jerusalem doesn't really happen until after the 1,000 years of the millennium.
I also believe that that's a pyramidal structure because it doesn't say it's cubic.
You're absolutely right. It's a gigantic mothership of a pyramid of some kind, and that happens according to the Great Pyramid prophecies. That doesn't happen until the year, 2989.
All right. Not a lot of time left. First time caller line, you're on the air with Sean David Morton. Hi.
Hey, Art.
Hello.
How's things going?
What can we do for you, dear?
I just wanted to say hi.
Okay, hi.
Hi.
Bye. I guess some people just can't resist.
Can't resist to say hello. Huh?
That's right. Wild Card Line, you're on the air with Sean David Morton. Hi.
Hi, this is Jerry in L.A.
Yes, Jerry.
Hey, the Hale-Bopp Comet has been estimated to be last time around 4,200 years ago.
Yep.
You were talking about the pyramid. You know, in the pyramid, you know, the descending passage, there's a scored line that points to Halcyon, and the date is 2141. I think that's pretty close. That's only 62 years off of the 4,200.
Yep.
So, well, do you have a comment on that?
I was under the impression that Hale-Bopp. Now, let me ask you a question, Art.
Sure.
I was under the impression that Hale-Bopp, that they had estimated that the last time it came around was nearly 8,000 years ago. Or is that Hayao Kitake? I'm getting my comments.
No, I think it was 4,200. I talked to Alan Hale the other night. We interviewed him. I think it was 4,200. But even I can't remember now, so.
Alan Hale or David Hale?
Alan Hale. Oh, okay. Alan Hale, the co-discoverer of the comet.
Oh, okay. I thought you were talking about the skipper on Gilligan's Island.
No. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Sean David Morton. Hi.
Hi, Art. This is John. I'm calling from El Cajon.
Yes, John.
Yeah, I was just calling to say that I wondered if Sean knew whether or not that if by having... He was saying something earlier about the family coming closer together or something.
Yes.
If whether or not that's some sort of significant sign as far as keeping yourself and your family, you know, from getting or being involved in something more serious down.
Yes, of course it is. Right, Sean?
Yes, of course. I mean, that's what it all has to do with, is fixing your family relationships and bringing that closer together, because we're just, you know, we're running out of time before bigger and grander things begin to happen, and you have to have all that stuff clear in your life in order for you to make the jump forward.
An awful lot of what's immediately ahead in late 97, 98, some of this truly horrific stuff you've talked about, unavoidable, can still be avoided?
I think that right now it's looking like about 60% of it can be avoided. I mean, it's all about... Any prophecy or prediction can be changed by intelligent action. If I simply thought that the planet was going to go spinning off into the sun, I mean, you know, why bother, Art? I mean, unless by talking to people about this stuff, by trying to inform them, by doing brain surgery on them, by jumping inside their heads and dancing around and doing the dance that we do to try to change the mind of the 21st century. That's the motto of my newsletter, is to work for the enlightenment of all sentient beings and to change the mind of the 21st century by giving people information by which to go on to change the masses. And now more than ever, with the universal mind, with the internet, with the fax machines, with all the communications that we've got, you know, it's unfortunate that so many of the communications apparatuses are controlled by the bad guys, I think. But with all of this, this is the time now to be speaking out, to doing the things we're doing, and allowing us to create that bright, brilliant, amazing future that we could all have if we all just pull together.
All right, my friend, that'll have to be the final word. The program's over. You did it. You went the whole way. A 5-hour program, Sean. Thank
you. We rock and rolled, Art.
We did. Thank you so very much, Sean. Listen, we will, of course, do it again.
Okay.
I am going to give you what I call the honors, which is simply tell them all good night.
Well, good night. I'll see everybody in Seattle next week, and I'll see everybody in New York next month. Good night to Mitch and Gwen and Eric Bigginhoe out there and all my pals. Thanks a lot. And thank you, Art. You're doing
night all.
Work.
Night all. Thank you, Sean. That's it, everybody. To get a copy of this program one last time, please note the number 1-800-917-4278 from the high desert. Good night, Cosmos.